Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 21st, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept, host of Counterpoints, co-host of Counterpoints, Ryan Grimm will be with us, specifically in part to talk about his piece on AIPAC and its allied super PAC crushing progressive challengers this past cycle. Then we'll be talking to Ben Dixon on the ground in Mississippi, covering the case of Jaheim McMillan, teen shot in the head by the cops. Then give them a revolution. That's right. Ben Burgess and Jason Miles will be here to talk about their super group show happening this weekend in Los Angeles that will include our very own Matt Leck.
That is a crossover episode for the ages.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, top headline, Rob Schneider says he's had it with the Democratic Party.
Oh, no.
He's going to become a Republicanino.
Ooh.
No, that's not really the top headline. Steve Bannon gets 4 months in prison and owes a fine for his contempt charges. Republican lawsuits in attempts to stop student debt relief, all shut down by the courts. No standing. New report, Trump's stolen documents had classified secrets about the Iranians and Chinese governments. And a Trump-appointed New York federal judge blocks New York State's ban on guns in places of worship. Georgia early voting continues to break records. Meanwhile, Nevada polls sound an alarm. Catherine Cortez Masto down by 2 points. Cisco in Syracuse is the food services company, not the computer technology company. In Syracuse, Boston, and Arizona win their strike. Meanwhile, teachers in Haverhill, Mass., settle their strike after 4 days. And North Carolina Republican senatorial candidate Ted Budd apparently got a low-cost personal loan and campaign cash after pushing for a bank merger that ended up costing North Carolinians thousands of jobs. That comes from Lever News. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program, folks. It is Casual Friday. As you can see, I am wearing my soft-collared shirt. Emma Vigeland's here. Not even bothering to wear.
No collar. This is my resistance for the show. So I don't even know what
to wear. Do you wear collars?
No, yeah. Not really. I mean, I have to differentiate myself somehow from you.
There you go. You're not wearing glasses today, so that helps.
No.
Two quick IMs just because they caught my eye. Clown Shoe Mike says, please talk about Mike Itkus, the independent candidate running against Jerry Nadler. I'll buy a tushy if you do, please. I meant to get to this. My friend John Benjamin has been sending me images of Mike Itkus's work. He is getting out ahead of a sex tape that is apparently out there.
Wow.
Of him. He's running for office in New York City. He is in favor of he's in favor of sex outside of marriage.
Yeah, so this sex tape, this was leaked on purpose for publicity, right?
I don't know.
That never happens.
I don't know. Okay. I don't know. I haven't seen the sex tape. I've only seen images from the sex tape, thanks to my friends.
I think that's he's claiming, though. I think Itkus is claiming that it was for campaign purposes, but, you know.
That he did it for campaign purposes.
But who's saying?
Well, at least he's being transparent.
It's a good use of campaign funds.
You know, I need to do more research on that before I comment any further.
Before we air it.
Vermont Ben, how serious should we take the Federalist piece on further aggressive radicalization of the right? You should not take it too seriously. I'm going to get into that on probably on Monday or Tuesday. We'll talk about it. I don't know if you saw this piece in the Federalist where they finally basically come out of the closet, as it were, and say, we've got to stop calling it the conservative movement. Now, this was an argument I was making in 2004 when Andrew Sullivan was talking about conservatism. I mean, it was basically talking about conservatism in the same way that one might say that, like, oh, I'm going to try and revive Latin as a, you know, the language still exists, but it is not, it is a dead language. And, of course, that's what conservatism is. It is really just it's reactionaries. They're reactionaries and revanchists. But we'll get into it. I mean, at the very least, they're coming out and saying, like, let's not pretend anymore. Let's just go full on to the fascism. We'll get more into that. But speaking of someone who's been trying to stir up a little bit of fascism around the globe.
Oh, it's his proud project.
Yes.
Trying to start a fascism university in Europe, basically.
Well, one of the funny things, too, speaking of fascism, is that Berlusconi, the former prime minister of Italy, who was, you know, certainly fasci in his own way, part of the coalition that has brought in Prime Minister Meloni, apparently tapes have come out where he has expressed solidarity with Putin and undercuts a little bit of Meloni's claims to be against Russian aggression in Ukraine. So we'll see how that turns out. But one of the guys who undoubtedly has been working with folks like that, if not those folks.
Oh, no, they're buddies, yes. Meloni and Steve Bannon.
Here is Steve Bannon walking into the courtroom this morning. Unbeknownst to him, he was going to walk out of this courtroom a couple hours later with a verdict that he spent 4 months in jail and also owe some fines for his contempt of Congress.
How you doing, brother?
Traitor! Traitor!
Traitor!
Thank you, ma'am.
Traitor!
I want to thank all you guys
traitor!
For coming. Remember, this illegitimate regime, their judgment day is on 8 November when the Biden administration ends. I want to thank you all for coming. Thanks. By the way, and remember, take down the CCP. Thank you.
Yeah, well, he's going to appeal it, apparently. I'd imagine that he'll be in some sort of cushy, low-security situation and maybe get out within 2 months, even though sentence is four. And then he'll get what he wanted, which was some sort of political martyrdom for his fascist project. But it's still good to see him taken down a peg, at least even if it's temporarily.
Well, I mean, it is important, I think, on some level, if Congress calls you to testify, that you be required to testify in particular. I mean, I'm not a big fan of prison or people going to prison necessarily, although I am certainly willing to make certain exceptions in certain cases.
Not entirely against it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, I, Maybe in a broader sense, in practice, there are some people who I would like to put in some form of jail for a long, long time. He's one of them. There are others. But I've wished worse things on, well, arguably worse people. So there it is. Steve Bannon. Bye-bye. Meanwhile, we're going to be talking to Ryan Grimm. I don't know. Bannon seemed to think that it would end the Biden administration on November 8th. Of course, Biden's not running for re-election, if he does, for another 2 years. So,
well, I mean, but that's when the installation of Donald Trump happens.
It's just like a millennial
on 8chan.
Cult.
I mean, come on. You don't understand. This is when Q's about to strike.
Exactly. It's like it's a millennial cult. It's just the next date. They'll just push it, keep pushing it back.
I know.
Exactly.
Right.
We're going to be talking to Ryan Grimm in just a moment or two about his piece. Today's program, sponsored by one of my favorite sponsors, SunsetLakeSebade.com. If you use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, you get 20% off. My sister called me and she's like, those THCA CBD gummies, they have them with just a 0.3, I think it is, of THCA, which, of course, is legal. You can ship that across the country. She said she got, like, leveled by them.
They're good, and they taste like mango or something.
I know.
Like
that's
that.
The problem I have with gummies. It's like at one point I lose sight that it's not just something to eat.
Right.
That's why I got to stay away from edibles of all sorts. But if you're one of those people who can actually measure yourself, you got to try those out. They're fantastic. Of course, they have the sour CBD gummies. That they've had for a long time. And they have sleep gummies that are elderberry with some melatonin in them. Those are great. I can eat those and just have one or two. But I also use the CBD tincture for sleeping and for just generally calming down. My kids are driving me crazy. Also, sometimes after a meal, I'll have a CBD smokable. They have pre-rolls. They got these big blunt things. They got keef. They got flour. You should check it out. Of course, they also have fudge. They have CBD infused coffee. They have CBD lotion. And they also have a great salve that has arnica in it that I repeatedly will get emails from people saying, gave it to my grandmother. She swears by it. For me, I found it very helpful. Oddly enough, for mosquito bites for Saul and for eczema for me. That's a little bit off label usage, but I mean, whatever. I report, you decide. SunsetLakeSebade.com. Left is best, 20% off. They're a great company. Movement partners. They've donated thousands of dollars to things like food pantries and strike funds and refugee resettlement and Innocence Project and Give Directly. They have great business practices, $20 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company. They have great farming practices. They practice integrated pest management and regenerative farming. Just an all-around great company, great folks who run the thing. Check it out, SunsetLakeSebade.com. They are fans of the show, and they chose their coupon code LEFTISBEST for 20% off. Okay, quick break. When we come back, Ryan Grimm. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for The Intercept and the host of the newly minted Counterpoints. Yeah. I should say co-host. And that's why he's wearing a suit that's now right. when he shows up on the show.
On Fridays, that's right. Anytime you have me on a Friday now, you're gonna get the nice coat, spiffy. Tie.
It's casual Friday, and you show up overdressed.
With makeup
time.
On.
Yeah. No, you look great.
Ryan's just trying to tell you who's really the boss around here.
Yeah, I know. Right?
The boss is the one that shows up disheveled, like with a t-shirt.
Okay. There we go. I win.
All right. So, Ryan Grimm, you have this massive piece, and you've been talking about this for a while, obviously, and it was something that happened during the primaries. Let's talk about this, and then we can broaden out to the elections in general and everything that's going on. But a people-powered insurgency threatened to reshape the Democratic Party. Then came AIPAC and its allied super PAC, Democratic Majority for Israel. This is sort of it's not a full sequel, but it's sort of a sequel to your book that you wrote about, you know, what took place in 2018 and what led up to it in terms of like a new crop of a younger generation of progressive Democrats who are coming in with hopes of taking over the party. And on some level, we were primed to have like three or four new members, maybe of the squad or Justice Democrats or progressive, however you want to sort of like label that, in the run-up to the 2022 midterms. And then AIPAC showed up. You want to start with Alejandro Frost? You want to start with Nina Turner? Where does the story start?
Yeah, I think you're right, actually, that it works as a bookend or a sequel to that, you know, the book was called We've Got People, which came from this AOC phrase from her ad, which was they've got money, but we've got people. And we originally were actually going to headline this story, They've Got Money, as a callback to that. Now, there was a big photo of an AIPAC conference as the lead photo. And the combination of those two things looked a little, looked anti-Semitic. I'm like, okay, that's not what we're trying to go for here.
That's why if you need a Jewish beard to do stuff like that in the future, I'm available.
but the point is true that, you know, it was people powered, voter powered, and then incomes starting in 2019. You know, it depends on where you want to start. You know, remember the first target of DMFI was actually the Jewish Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders in the presidential campaign, and setting the pattern, none of the ads that they ran against him in the lead up to the Iowa caucuses were about Israel or Palestine. They were all about how he had a heart attack and he's like too much of a socialist. And they hammered him through Iowa, through New Hampshire and Nevada. And then they threw in the towel and it went after Nevada. And when they threw in the towel, that was kind of one of the like high water marks for Bernie. They're like, we have pushed through this. And now we're cruising. Didn't happen. But that then that next cycle, they spent a couple $1 million against Jamal Bowman when they realized that his race was against Elliot Engel was serious, because Elliot Engel, one of the most outspoken kind of Israel hawks in Congress, and also was the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee. So to have him go down to a Justice Democrat candidate in a district with a, you know, sizable, you know, Jewish community, and then embarrassingly to them, it appears to have lost the Jewish vote to Jamal Bowman, really undercuts their argument that this is some anti-Semitic movement. No, it's not. It's not. It's uncritical support of unlimited spending on. Military support for Israel is not a popular issue in Democratic primaries, and so that's why they don't run. DMFI and AIPAC don't run on that issue.
It's also it's not a popular position amongst American Jewry, period. Too. I mean, exactly.
That's why those precincts went Jamal Bowman.
And we should say, you know, broadly speaking, I think the numbers are somewhere around 70-75% of American Jewry is far to the left of AIPAC on the question of Israel. In this country now, your support for Israel, to the extent that it comes from the Jewish community, is maybe 25%, 30% in terms of like the way that our policy is now, without change. And then the a lot district, of it comes from Christian Zionists. But
and the district that really shows you that is New York 10. This Dan Goldman versus Mondaire Jones versus Yulin Nu, heavy Jewish vote in that district. And AIPAC ended up spending $350,000 to support Dan Goldman in that district. They announced that they had done that after the election had happened. They didn't even use their original super PAC, which was called what? United Democracies Fund or something like that. They created a brand new super PAC. And what you can do in these primaries is if you create a new super PAC, it can start running ads, and then its first disclosure is not until after the election.
Right.
So AIPAC.
Thank you, Anthony Kennedy, incidentally. Yeah,
right. And so AIPAC in Manhattan had to hide the fact that it was supporting Dan Goldman. Otherwise, it would have blown back against them, even in that district. So if they can't, and so that goes to your point that they're down 2-1, 3-1 on this particular question. But as I point out in the story, they don't run on that issue. They like with Nina Turner, they were just highlighting kind of like her bowl of crap comment that she had made.
How much, and we can go through some of the specifics, but like how much of an innovation, for lack of a better word, is this where a single issue group, right, comes in, pours money in, but not to have anything to do with that issue. I mean, you know, barely bringing it up, but rather just looking for generic weaknesses that they can exploit. I mean, because the dynamic usually is, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm a group that represents, you know, right-wing Israel advocacy, theoretically, I want to be able to show my funders, like, look at how we're promoting right-wing Israeli advocacy in this race. You could substitute anything for it. On the left, it would be, you know, abortion rights or, expansion of Medicare or whatever it is that you're associated with. How much of an innovation is it that a group will come in, spend this kind of money, and really not make it about their issue, but rather just go with someone as way of either, and you could, as you get into this, you can outline like that what they're doing is they're trying to silence and shape the Democratic Party so that there are no either genuine critics or there are no, you know, critics who are willing to articulate a criticism of our policy, foreign policy relationship with Israel.
It's an innovation in the sense that they've cut out some of the middlemen of the party apparatus. I mean, so when big corporate money, you know, gets spent in primaries or in general elections, you know, it'll go to a House Democratic PAC or a Republican, you know, a House PAC, and then that will be transformed into an ad about how this person, you know, is for defund the police, or if they're a Republican, how they want to throw grandma off the cliff or whatever. The money is coming from, you know, cable companies or drug companies or oil companies. So they're not running oil company ads, you know, but they're, like you said, they're laundering it kind of through these either kind of a party super PAC or an outside super PAC, like something that Karl Rove runs or something like that. And so the innovation here is that they're like, no, we're just going to do our own super PACs and we're going to just fund them exclusively ourselves. And then we're going to pick whatever races we want to pick. And then we're going to have Mark Melman run a bunch of polling. And then we're going to just hammer whatever we think worked in that district. And I quote this interview that Dave Weigel did with Howard Kaur, who's the CEO of AIPAC, who doesn't give many interviews. And Weigel pressed him on this question. And he's like, well, we want to run ads on things that people in the district care about, which is really kind of revealing, really revealing answer.
It's well, like, yeah, well, this is... yeah. How much do you know? I mean, and I'm sure that it's given our campaign finance disclosure laws, it's probably really hard to figure this out. But do you have a sense of where the money is coming from when it's coming into AIPAC? Like, is it is the innovation also that right-wing groups and corporate groups see AIPAC as like a useful stalking horse to just weed out leftists that might say raise their taxes? Like, they might be agnostic, pardon the turn of phrase, on the issue of Israel, but that they know that if you're going to be supportive of Palestinian rights, you also probably want Medicare for all and to raise taxes on the wealthy, for example.
Right, right. It's a win-win in that sense. And so for this super PAC, they raised and spent around $40 million. $8.5 million of it came directly from AIPAC, which means that it's pure dark money. You can't actually find out where that came from because it's coming through their various C4s. But then the rest of it actually is disclosed in the FEC. And so you get people like Phil Singer, Republican hedge fund baron. You get Bernie Marcus, the CEO of Home Depot, actually $2 million from that dude who founded WhatsApp and sold it for like $20 billion or whatever. Like, he gave $2 million to AIPAC. So some of that might be just purely ideological money. Like, now this is somebody who's a multi-billionaire who also is, not interested in having people running around Congress saying that every billionaire is a policy failure. But it might also just be pure ideological, pro-Israel, pro-right-wing Israel money. So you can go through the list, and it's all like, it's like pro sports team owners, it's hedge fund people, it's private equity executives, it's real estate barons. It's the wealthiest people in the country, then, which you would expect when, the bulk of the money is raised from people who were able to give checks of like $100,000 and up. Like, the $100,000, there were some who were giving a little bit less than that, and it looked like those might be, all often around the same date. So there's some fundraiser where everybody's chipping in 10,000. But then oftentimes you're seeing 100,000, 250, 500 million, $2 million contributions.
Put into context for us the implications of this money within the context of a primary. Like, I mean, are we talking like how big relative to how distortive is this?
Yeah. So as a function, and I talked to a couple of consultants about this who pointed out that as a function of the structural racism that has kind of created our political economy, a lot of these congressional Black caucus districts, the hard money and hard dollars are what are given directly to a candidate, capped at what, $2,800 per cycle. There's not a lot of money in those districts. You might have an entire race where the candidate raises $300,000 to $400,000, and so in the Donna Edwards race, for instance, which is PG County in Maryland, they combined to spend more than $7 million against her, just multiples of money. And so I interviewed Logan Bayroff, who's ended up running the outside money group for J Street, kind of combating DMFI. And so they watched in 2020 as DMFI spent several million dollars. And they said they expected DMFI to spend $6, $7, $8 million in the 2022 cycle. So they went around raising money. They raised about $2 million from kind of super rich liberals who wanted to use J Street to counteract the DMFI matches. So they're like, we feel like outspent 2-1 or 3-1. Like, it's a fair fight because voters prefer our message.
Right.
So we can win this. And then boom, along comes AIPAC dropping $40 million. And by picking these individual races, so like in North Carolina spending.
So they're outspent almost 20-1.
Right. Right. And if you add in WFP was the biggest outside spender. So then maybe they ended up being 10-1 in the end. And so if you go race by race, the pattern that you see is that everywhere that they were outspent by like 10-1, they lose, like progressives lose, 6-1 they lost most of them. You know, when it gets down to like 3-1 or 2-1, then Progressives won most of those races. Clean up and down fights, Progressives won almost all of them. So like Summer Lee, for instance, was outspent something like 2-1. And a 2-1 gap is something that a skilled politician with a base can overcome. So basically the calculation is like the ratio. You can't be outspent by too much, and you need a minimum amount of money. Like what that minimum is isn't exactly clear, but you need a minimum to get your message out, and then you can't be outspent too badly.
That's pretty conclusive for Apex. For their kind of, I guess, goals, right? They have a blueprint for, I mean, this is an incredibly successful test run for them.
Especially when they can save money in districts, and like we talked about with Kassar, with Fetterman, with Frost, they didn't spend it all in those races and kind of got, they didn't, you know, the Progressives still won, so they're not happy about that, but they did get major concessions on their stated policy of, you know, Israel-Palestine.
All right, I want to get to that part in a second, but I just want to reiterate what Emma is saying, is that if Ryan Grimm can figure this out, with all due respect, then there's some dude in the AIPAC office who's like got a sheet of paper and going down the hall and saying, so guys, here's the formula.
5-1.
If we really want to win, we got to go from 5 to 10 to one. That's it. And we know how much they can raise. It's pretty obvious. So here's the number. Here are the districts. Here's the number we got to hit. And what makes this, because I remember when they lost those races in 2020, there was one race that they lost, and there was, everybody breathed a sigh of relief and saying like, okay, so their pilot program or their proof of concept failed, so they won't try this again. Uh-huh. And of course, what they did is like, oh, okay, we're going to just spend more.
We need to quintuple the amount we spent.
And now their ability to go to these deep pocketed people, and say, this is it. We have the formula now. It's just a question of whether we can hit it. That makes these people go like, okay, if you can promise me a return on this investment, before you came to me for, you know, 500,000 and you couldn't deliver, but you're telling me if you give me a million guaranteed results, I'm going to give you a million. And so this is the next time they do this, their rate of return is going to be higher. And it seems to me it's also going to implicate when they go, like, tell the story of those three you mentioned, where they basically say, we don't have to spend this money. We just need to threaten to spend this money, and we'll get what we want, at least in terms of this narrow set of policies from these people. Give us an example of that, because I would imagine having the formula set means in the future they're not even going to offer that as much. They're just going to go like, we're just going to get rid of you because our fundraising is up, and we don't need to bluff in these situations because we now know the formula.
Right. Although if they want to spend, let's say they end up raising 80 million next cycle, and they want to outspend, you know, 5-6-1, you know, you start doing the math, that's only 10 or 15 races that they can play in the whole country. And there might be more than that where they want to have influence. So they do still want to have some of that chilling effect, I think, because especially if Democrats lose, you know, a decent number of seats, and not just the seats that they lost, but the seats they lost in 2020, you're going to have in 2024 a lot of open primaries where Democrats are kind of jockeying back and forth. And that's on top of the people who are getting primaried. So there will probably be more races than they want to play and than they can even afford, believe it or not.
So let me just, if I understand that last part, is that to the extent that they have a constraint, not just in terms of how much money they raise, but they don't, they want there to be some incumbency. So they want to keep Democrats, at least. They don't want Democrats to lose that many seats, so they can't get really crazy with this, because if they do, that means that they're going to have to actually participate in more races in the future. And is that it? I mean, is that...
No, not necessarily. I'm just saying that the year itself is just likely to have more primaries. Like, there weren't as many primaries these last two cycles as there were in 2018. And 2024 could end up being more like closer to 2018, where you have lots of different primaries that they have to contend with. And then the money does end up becoming a problem. Because if you have to spend $7 million to guarantee yourself to win a race, and you do 10 races, that's $70 million, you know, which is more than they raised this cycle. So at some point you're running up against, I mean, there aren't limits because, you know, we're talking about billionaires here. So they actually could just raise $700 million from, you know, if they just went to the same people that donated to them in 2020, they could raise $700 million. It's just a question of would they give it?
Yeah,
it's like, why wouldn't they?
It's like the interest. They're not even, they don't have to work for that money. Billions of dollars. Right. They just like, yeah, I'm going to dedicate the interest to this.
Well, they feel a lot poorer because the market's down probably.
I'm going to get one less trip to Mars out of this or whatever it is that they think they're doing. Okay. So, but give an example of people that they leaned on and they were sort of like the candidate preempted by saying, I'm not going to be a problem on this issue.
Yeah. And so, you know, Fetterman and Frost were, I think, actually pretty similar in how it unfolded. And Greg Kassar is in Austin. And I think that was a little bit of a separate issue.
And you're talking Maxwell Frost.
Right. So Maxwell Frost, who ran in Orlando, they call him the first Gen Z candidate. But what about that Republican guy that they threw out?
Cawthorn.
Yeah. Wasn't he Gen Z?
I don't know.
Anyway, the second Gen Z, first Gen Z Democrat, let's call him.
Right.
We don't want to sell Cawthorn short.
Apparently, Cawthorn's a millennial. Mm. So
really, they're calling him a millennial.
I guess we've gotta own him then. Yep.
There you go.
Anyway, so in both these cases, take Fetterman first. Fetterman, is DMFI. You know, I don't remember who reached out to who first, but the campaign, you know, sat down early on in the race, in the Pennsylvania Senate race with, you know, Fetterman campaign and DMFI sit down to talk Israel-Palestine policy. Because if, as your viewers will remember, there was Malcolm Kenyatta running on the left who had, you know, was going to get 10-15% of the vote. And then you had Connor Lamb running as the centrist Democrat who was actively publicly pleading for a super PAC to come in and rain down, you know, death and destruction upon John Fetterman. It was getting really desperate toward the end, but it was a central part. Like, that was part of his strategy. Like, the reason I'm going to be Fetterman is that we're going to get super PAC support. And that never ended up coming. And it's the significant super PAC that they were hoping would come in was DMFI. And so the Fetterman campaign sits down, they talk Israel-Palestine policy. And Mark Melman even gave an interview on this to Jewish Insider where he said, the Fetterman campaign drafted their Israel-Palestine policy paper and sent it to DMFI. DMFI made notes on it, edits, kicked the edits back to the Fetterman campaign. He said they were very receptive to the edits. Once the edits were done, Fetterman does an interview with Jewish Insider, which covered all of these primaries, and is a really great source of information for following these primaries. He does an interview where he said, you may remember this, he famously said, I'm not progressive on that issue. I'm not with the squad. He's like, and if you don't even ask me this, let me make sure, you know, that I tell you right now, I was appalled by that Iron Dome vote. He just laid it all out. And then DMFI is like, you know what? We're not, sorry, Connor Lamb. Like, we're not spending in this race. In the Maxwell Frost race in Orlando, DMFI in January, of 2022 endorsed a state senator there who Randolph Bracey. He had been on an AIPAC sponsored trip several years earlier. He's a, you know, outspoken supporter of AIPAC. Like, he was AIPAC's guy in that race. From the reporting I gathered, he was very much under the impression that major super PAC spending was coming his way. At some point, his campaign reaches out to both DMFI and AIPAC. It's like, hey guys, you endorsed me back in January. It's getting kind of late. Where's this super PAC money? And they're like, yeah, so actually, looks like that's not going to happen. Maxwell Frost has had a lot of people reaching out to us. influential people like Richie Torres, who we could talk about. And you know, his new policy on Israel Palestine is good, and so we're not actually going to spend in this race. And so Frost had gone from, and I kind of picked his story as the one to kind of be the vehicle to tell this narrative, because he had gone from an active member of the Florida Palestine Network. You know, his friends and allies were, protesting the Gaza war. He spoke at the Gaza war rally. He had signed petitions supporting BDS. Even during the campaign, he had told the organization he still supported BDS. Very few BDS supporters in the House, period. So for even him to be able to be kind of moved on that issue by the end of the campaign, such as DMFI spelt and AIPAC decided not to spend, just shows, you know, how much pressure there is, because you can, and it's fine to be critical of Frost for all that. And a lot of people are, but also we can't have a system that requires heroes like who are going to stand up to insurmountable pressure.
I mean, the issue isn't even heroes at that point. It's martyrs. Right. I mean, because
that's true.
Because
that's true.
It's like we now, just as much as they have their data to show how they can be effective, we on the, you know, the left of the Democratic Party now are clear, like, we need to figure out something else to protect these people with these positions, because they're going to lose.
Right.
If they like, and we're going to lose all of their stated positions. Now, look, Fetterman, once you're a senator for 6 years, you get into that second term, things could loosen up a little bit. You know, we're talking 8 years out there. He becomes an incumbent, much, much harder to defeat him in a primary. Right. Not the exact same dynamic with House members, but still, the amount of money to dislodge an incumbent in a primary is much, much greater than it is to knock off a challenger. So, you know, we can hope that some of these people are being insincere for the short term, but this is a real problem.
Right.
Is there anybody, the next piece that you're writing, is it going to be like, and here's the group that's going to fight. Who is that group? Who could it be?
Right. No, that's a really good point that you make. It's worth underlining. Like, he wouldn't have been a hero. He'd have been a martyr. AIPAC spends $3 million in that race.
And he's done. He loses. Period. Even, end of
even
story.
With the crypto support.
Yeah. He's done. So then because now they have their metric, and they're not going to lose.
Right. He only won by 3 or 4 points.
Yeah.
Right. So there is a group that's forming, that did form a coalition this cycle that had, you know, some pretty impressive results in, like I said, in races where they were within, you know, 2-1 or 3-1 getting outspent. And it includes, generally, the lead spender was Working Families Party. J Street spending $2 million. The Congressional Progressive Caucus PAC put in, you know, sizable buys, hundred thousands, you know, in the hundreds of thousands in a lot of these key races. Indivisible picked a couple of races and went in pretty heavy, in all of them kind of working in coalition. And Sunrise Movement also was part of this coalition. The question, but it's not about kind of small dollars anymore, unless you're going to get people like AOC and Bernie Sanders involved in fundraising for these candidates. You know, Bernie, he quote unquote declared war on AIPAC after, I think it was after the Nina Turner race, where they spent millions, and the DMFI spent millions and drove her into the ground. But declaring war for Bernie just means that, like, he says he's declaring war and then he's going to endorse candidates, but he doesn't put his operation, like, he hasn't set anything up that says, well, I have the capacity to raise $50 million. Let's say, I don't know if he does or not in a non-presidential cycle, but let's say he could raise $10, $20 million.
He hasn't built that apparatus to do so.
It's the thing that shuts down after the presidential campaign.
Let me ask you this. In terms of, let's say, AOC, who has a lot of fundraising powers, right? Maybe not necessarily Bernie level, but up there, maybe more. I don't know. How much of an issue is it to be going into to having to play in more races in terms of these primaries as a member of the House who may be, I mean, my sense, you would have more sense of this than I would, but it feels to me like there is an active agenda of some of these progressives in Congress to start to build, see past an era when Pelosi is gone, see that there isn't going to be necessarily the same consolidation of power that there has been in the House over the past 15, 20 years, an active effort to build bridges with people who don't share necessarily their politics in the House, but there's a certain amount of horse trading. You vote for me on this, maybe I'll vote you on for that. How much does her or any progressive in the House, as opposed to Bernie Sanders, let's say, playing in these races, how much does that interfere with that project?
I mean, it certainly interferes on one level, but it also then builds power on another level. And I think that the squad in particular is never going to be in leadership. They're never going to be people that can build bridges all the way across the caucus. Like that's done. Like that's, they are the kind of insurgent faction. And no matter what they try to do, nobody believes it from them elsewhere in the caucus. That, you know, particularly in 2020, there were more than 100 primary challenges to incumbent Democrats, and Justice Democrats was behind, you know, fewer than 10 of those. And I think the squad was behind basically close to zero of them, eventually ended up supporting some of them. But incumbents thought that they were behind every single one of those 100 plus. And so they're kind of like,
They're damned if they do. Right. They're damned if they don't. So they might as well do.
They might as well do it. Now, Jayapal, right. Okay. somebody like a Jayapal, does have ambitions to build, you know, cross party relationships, and in order to do that, there's, you know, you can be nice, but you can also win and build power.
Right.
Hakeem Jeffries has a pack. Gottheimer, you know, is out there spending a lot of his money supporting, you know, right-wing Democrats. It's a very normalized thing to support a particular candidate in an open primary. That's the key. It has to be an open primary. Once you're playing in a primary against an incumbent, that culturally, you know, is something that is, you know, your persona non grata if you're trying to then run for leadership later. But if it's an open primary, totally legit. And the Progressive Caucus PAC, which has, you know, raise and spend a decent amount of money, is playing in those races. Now they're hamstrung in a lot of ways. Like, for instance, they didn't play in the Rhode Island 2, you know, David Siegel
right.
race. And, you know, the reporting that I've done suggested that was David Cicilline, who's the other member from Rhode Island, didn't want them weighing in on that. David Cicilline is a member of the Progressive Caucus. If you've got 90 plus incumbents who are part of your Progressive Caucus, you're going to have a lot of people vetoing what races you can get in.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's all sorts of institutional hurdles because the institution wants to preserve its status quo.
Well, listen, I want to talk to you more about this. We'll have time in the coming months because this stuff is not going away. And it's a fascinating piece. It's a long read. People should read it. Nice. It's over at The Intercept. We're going to link to it. We got to get to Ben Dixon, but we'll pick this up at another time. Really depressing, but also important to understand, like, you know, how this stuff works, because if you're going to be involved in electoral politics, obviously not the only way and shouldn't be the only way that you do get involved in politics. But if you're going to, you should understand what the different forces yeah. acting in these situations are. And this is a really good place to start. Ryan Grimm, as always, a pleasure. You look wonderful. Really appreciate you.
I really appreciate
dolling that. Yourself up for this. I really do. Thank you.
Yeah, glad I could do it.
All right. All right, folks, we're going to take well, we don't even have to take a quick break, do we?
No, that's okay. The beauty of the phone line.
We're going to Ben Dixon is on the phone. He is the proprietor of the Benjamin Dixon Show. He's in Mississippi. He is covering the case of Jaheim McMillan. Ben, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Sam. Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Thanks so much for joining
us. Good morning, Emma.
Hey, Ben. How are you?
Thank you guys for having me and helping me get the word out. Thank you so much.
I know that you, you're going to be doing a radio hit in about 5 minutes or so. So just I hadn't heard about this story. Tell us what is tell us about it.
Yeah. So what's going on? I came over to Gulfport, Mississippi, after seeing the mother of Jaheim McMillan just wailing, crying on the Internet after the police in Gulfport shot her son point blank range in front of their family dollar store, their corner store that he was known by name. So it wasn't a strange store to him. Police officers pulled into the driveway and he and his friends started running because they have had a previous run in with this specific cop. Jaheim turned to comply, put his hands up, and this is according to multiple eyewitnesses that I've spoken to myself. He put his hands up and the police officer shot him anyway. It is so flagrant that the white supporters from Gulfport, Mississippi, one gentleman, we shared a video, he had on a thin blue line shirt, so he's pro-police, and he called out the shooting as point blank. He called him out as the police officer as a cold-blooded murderer and made it clear that he had his hands up and there was nothing in his hands. One last detail, Sam, he was shot in front of the family dollar store, and I came to town to try to get that footage. The footage for that day appears to have been deleted. The video footage for the day before, October 5th, is available. I can see it. The video footage for October 7th is there. It's available. I can see it. But when we search for October 6th, that video footage is no longer there.
Wait a second. All right. So to be clear, you're actually inside the dollar store in there, like looking at their security cam, and it's and
I have yes, and to be sure, I have video footage of that, and I can share that at a later time. I'm just trying to make sure that the that whatever I release is approved by the family,
right?
By the family's attorneys, more specifically. But I have video footage, and I can
see. So the dollar store people,
you will be able to see it yourself.
Just to be clear, like the management of the dollar store let you come in, check their video. Do they know who deleted it?
They have not. Okay, so I want to be clear. I can't give that particular detail simply because of our sources. But yes, that video has been deleted, and we do not know who. We do not know from Family Dollar yet. I've reached out to Family Dollar, and they have not returned my emails or my calls. We're trying to see if it was approved by Family Dollar or whether or not it was requested by the police. And it's even more, Sam. Every family member and every organizer that is involved in this has had each of their Facebook accounts restricted. So they got the word out initially through Facebook Live and all their live streams, but none of them are able to go live now. And I've confirmed and checked each of their phones. They have all been restricted from going live.
We're restricted by Facebook.
But this is specifically by Facebook, and it's each of the individuals. It wasn't until we got them all together to talk that they started comparing notes and realized they all had been restricted by Facebook.
Do you know any details about the system in which these things are deleted? Because there's sometimes where I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you delete something from a hard drive, if it is completely irrecoverable. I don't know, but I wonder if that's the case.
I'm quite sure it's recoverable simply because the digital trail goes a long way. And this is why we're leaning into Family Dollar. We need them to explain to us why some critical footage is unavailable. And if it has been provided to the police department, as it should, then we need to know why it was deleted from anyone else viewing.
Is there any type
of... who made that request?
Is there body cam footage?
They have stated that yes, there is body cam footage. The chief of police here has stated that they are not releasing that footage until the end of the year.
I bet. And so you mentioned that one guy with the thin blue line shirt was a witness. Are there any other witnesses? And are there any witnesses who don't whose you know, testimony, as it were, it's not actual testimony, but whose reports are inconsistent with that guy's report?
Sam, I lost you for a second there.
So you had the Thin Blue Line witness, the guy wearing that shirt, who said it was point blank, you know, no reason to do that. Is there any other witnesses, and is their witness accounts consistent with that other witness? Ben?
Ben. Yeah. He must have bad service.
Ben, are you there? Well, we've lost Ben. I think he's got another hit to do. We will get back with him at one point, if not today, in the future. But we will follow this. But it's obviously, I think, you know, you can go. We'll put a link to a story. This is from a week ago. Jaheim McMillan, witnesses contradict cops after Mississippi police shoot a black teen in the head. During a press briefing on Tuesday of, it must have been last week, the police chief said that McMillan was armed and did not comply with orders to drop a gun. Mm. And it sounds like, witnesses say that is not the case.
And it sounds like, them waiting to release the body cam footage suggests that that's not the case either.
I mean, it would be surprising if the body cam footage was consistent with the reports of the cops and their...
Well, they would release it right away if that were the case.
One would think.
Hmm.
One would think. Not the most fun of Fridays in terms of stories back to back. I'm sorry about that, folks, but that's what's going on this week. We will take a lighter note and talk to Ben Burgess and Jason Miles, who are going to join us. We don't have both of them yet.
They are
we?
Both here.
Okay,
now.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will I don't know. We'll play a little music maybe as a little bit of a palate cleanser and try and lighten the mood a little bit. It's Casual Friday after all. We'll be right back with what we're calling, and maybe they'll adopt it, the Give Them a Revolution show that is taking place in L.A. This week.
But Left Reckoning is excluded from...
Well, what we call them is... We reckon that we'll give them a revolution.
Correct.
Or we'll give them
a reckonlution. No, sucks.
That's
a
revolution.
We're going to work
shark.
On that.
Jump
we'll
the
be,
shark.
We'll be right back in a moment. We'll be right back.
will 100% for sure.
Sorry, we're back, Ben.
We are back. It's like the Brady Bunch. It is Casual Friday, folks, and we have two guests that are returning to the show. Ben Burgess, Jason Miles. This is part of one of the greatest crossover live shows in the history of crossover shows. Give them a revolution reckoning.
I could do it too if I chose to wear a sleeveless shirt that I'm just not going to show off.
Ben Burgess give them a debate.
Give him an argument.
Give him an argument, sorry. And Jason Miles, this is Revolution. Yeah. And Left Reckoning will be there. And also, like, there's a little bit of TYT in there.
Right, right.
And Nando Vila. Yeah. Huge show in L.A. And when is this happening? On Sunday?
Sunday.
I mean, Jason?
It's happening on Sundays, October 23rd at the Terragram Ballroom. I believe there's still some tickets available.
How is that possible? It's a huge venue.
It is a huge venue. I was a little nervous because the venue is so huge, and they said, we want to do your show. And I was like, word?
There's going to be some celebrities in attendance, too, from what I hear.
Is that right?
From the basketball podcasting world, there might be somebody.
Well, I'm sure there'll be other celebrities too there too.
It's going to be all kind of who's who's. I kind of wanted to get a red carpet for it for the podcast celebrities that were going to be there.
Yeah, we got folding chairs.
Where in LA is this located?
This is at the Terragram Ballroom.
No, but where is the Terragram Ballroom?
Downtown Los Angeles.
Indeed. Yes. It's downtown LA, my LA geography sucks, but I do know that much.
Should ask Jason that question.
Jason, tell us more about the Terragram Ballroom.
Los Angeles is in California.
But Jason, you're in Mexico though, right?
I'm in Mexico. About 3.5 hours south.
And you will cross the border and come into the United States. Tell us about the Terragram Ballroom. I've never been there. I mean, downtown L.A., when I spent most of my time in L.A., was just there was nothing there.
Downtown L.A. got totally redone over the last, I would say, 15 years or so.
Yeah.
I was downtown last month. I went and saw my son and his mom was doing some work downtown. So I got to stay down there, and him and I walked around downtown. I mean, it's still downtown L.A. that you remember. There definitely still is some shanty towns down there, but the gentrification is on another level.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more venues. There's a lot more, like, high-end restaurants. Like, my son's mom and I couldn't even really find a place to eat because we didn't even think to get reservations.
Wow.
We didn't think downtown LA was like that she, but no, it's a different LA.
I know.
You should come out.
Yeah.
That's what you guys kept saying, but it's a little short notice. Gotta say.
Jet set life of podcasters. I thought you guys could just get on a Southwest flight like that.
Oh, yeah. We are jet setting. That's how people describe Sam in particular.
It takes a lot.
Why don't you just take the MR jet?
It takes a lot. Oh, exactly. Right. We've got it out.
I have Peacock on the line, and they'll charter a plane for us.
Yeah, exactly. Haven't done any work for them for over a year, but if we want to use the jet, no problem.
blank check.
It takes a lot to get me to go to Los Angeles these days, to be totally honest.
Like an online date with a conservative.
If Right Stuff had let me in by now, which I should say, like, I probably shouldn't say this publicly because I don't want them to stop me from getting in. But I still am waiting for my invitation. It's been like three weeks. I don't think I'm getting in on the Right Stuff. But
the jig is up.
The jig is up. They must know that I'm going in there just basically to do a bit over and over again.
You should just be able to say in your application that you're a libertarian presidential candidate.
No kidding. And also, I was on that list of like big conservative influences from Bernie Kerik. Yeah. But no respect. No respect in those fields. All right, so how do you do this with like 45 people on the bill?
They took a lot of planning, actually.
No, but I mean, how are you going to do it in the future? What's going to happen? Are you guys going to be all on stage, Ben? Like arguing simultaneously?
Just not even waiting for each other to finish sentences. Just like it's going to be like a little performance art thing. It's very abstract. It's not
sensory overload.
Anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we'll have anybody who ever went to any of the live shows that Michael Brooks did, like, has, you know, some idea of like what this is like. So different, you know, groups of people will be on stage at different times to talk about different things. You know, we've so like, you know, if we're doing a thing where we talk about friend of the show, friend of all the shows, Dave Rubin, you know, like Anna Kasparian would be on for that. You know, if we're doing something where we're talking about foreign policy stuff, then we've got our friend Daniel Bessner up there, and, you know, stuff like that.
What, I mean, this might be a good time since we've got the both of you here, and obviously and Matt too is going to be there on stage with David Griscom. Give me your sense of like where we are today with in this sort of space relative to, like, I don't know, a year ago, let's say. I mean, it's weird because I feel like 5 years ago, there wasn't really this space. Mm-hmm. Even 6 years ago, it didn't exist. It was just a couple, I mean, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, nobody else.
It was like TYT, this show, Pac-Man, Kalinske.
Yeah.
I remember it.
Yeah. But so give me a sense from your perspective, Jason, and then yours, Ben.
Where we are in left media?
Yeah. I'm curious as to, and also maybe not just in left media, although, you know, to the extent that left media sort of reflects broadly the left in this country, at least in the context of, I mean, I think it's, well, I'll leave this to you, but I just think it's weird how centered some people on the nominal left put shows like this. I mean, you know, like,
I'll be honest with you, Sam. We did a show and your name came up in the show. Not even negatively.
That's surprising. Okay.
Why? We're friends. We're not like,
no. No, it was a rare case where Jason mentioned you and did shit on you. Like this time he did.
That guy. I didn't Kanye you. It wasn't like it was.
I appreciate that.
It wasn't like, and the problem with left media.
Gonna go DEFCON 3 on the majority.
DEFCON 3 on all Jewish leftists.
Right. But your name
came up, and what the conversation was about was parasocial relationships in relation to media consumption. And it wasn't negative, right? But that clip got more views than any other clip, and the engagement, there was like fights in the comments, and it wasn't even over what the person had said. It literally kind of made his point for him that there's so many parasocial relationships in this world. I mean, we're in people's homes, we're in people's cars, we're in people's heads for hours a day. This show, your show, Majority Report, is about 3 hours long. So, you know, for 3 hours, people know Sam Cedar, Emma Viglin, Matt Leck, Bradley. To a degree, they feel they know you. There is a very personal relationship that sometimes we, as the people that create these shows, might even deny on our end. And it was kind of shocking to see the comments that were left, because it was literally people arguing, yelling mad at us, then I got personal messages.
Well, because this is the clip that I think Gene actually kind of put this together as a test. If we put like Sam and I think Jimmy Dore's name was in there too, you know, as like a, you know, will people, you know, how will people react to that? Of course, you know, they reacted to it by having different kinds of Pavlovian reactions to the names. in the clip, you know, the clip title, instead of actually like what's said in the clip, which was like, it's weird how people relate to podcasters, basically, was the point. And that point was like very verified by the reaction to it. But yeah, I mean, it is a weird thing, right? Like that there is, and like something I try to emphasize all the time on my show is like, I really want people to understand that like consuming media is not politics. Right, like that people who's like a political commentator can like they can provide political education, political inspiration. These are all like useful auxiliary things, but it's ultimately commentator, you know, commenting. Yes. It's not like thinking that like, and like when people talk about podcasters as if they're like leaders of political factions, that always seems strange to me. Sort of on the level of like thinking that like, I don't know, Skip Bayless would be a good quarterback because he talks about football so much.
Right.
Cyber Leninism is what we jokingly call it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the parasocial stuff is particularly strange insofar as like, you know, people had this relationship with Howard Stern, right? And you know, Baba Booey and the intern and this and that, all that stuff. I mean, that to me is not that sort of unique or problematic in and of itself, like that, because in radio certainly lends itself to it. And I think, you know, what we do here is more of a radio show than anything else, you know, aside from our delivery mechanism. But the part that you point out, Ben, about people mistaking that, which I think is like a normal parasocial thing. Like, you know, we're on for 3 hours. We're with people when they're doing other things. We become sort of a soundtrack for people's lives on some level. You know, people hopefully learn stuff, but like, we're not activists in doing this. We're tools of activists. Mm-hmm. We're here to help activists. We're not activists. We are no more on some level, like we're glorified flyers, essentially. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, nobody would look at a flyer and say, like, that's an activist. Mm-hmm. No, it's the activists wrote the flyers, printed them out, put them on the, you know, on the light posts so they can help with their activism. That's how I've always perceived our job. Our job is to amplify specific voices, call attention. We have some editorial, job and like, picking what stories we think are important for people to be aware of so that they can go out and do stuff. But there are like, there's this other sort of like attitude that has developed, it seems to me, that is like, we're political players. Like when I see people, for better or for worse, either way, it doesn't matter, saying like, you know, leaders of the left, like, what are you talking about?
No.
The best comment I ever read, and this person actually had, they stopped being a patron of This Is Revolution. They said, Sam Cedar single-handedly destroyed the opportunity to have Medicare for all because he was against forced.
I really wish you hadn't done that. Frankly, because I would reject Medicare for all.
I mean, look, to be honest, like, yeah, I have problems. I shouldn't have done that either. I mean, like the rates on insurance have gone through the roof. We're just like talking about that.
Everybody makes mistakes. We can't have purity tests on the left, even though Sam single-handedly killed the prospects of Medicare for all from ever happening. I mean,
no, you know, I mean, because
Big Ten party.
Because if Sam had said that some congresswomen should have done this like one particular parliamentary maneuver that would have been on C-SPAN for 5 minutes 2 years ago, then we would have Medicare for all. And I don't know why you love the private insurance industry, but I've got to say I don't.
Well, no, I would have been, I mean, imagine if I wasn't in favor of Medicare for all, what kind of damage I could have done.
Anyone ever seen the butterfly effect? Because Sam set off a chain of reactions here.
Let's not bring up the Civil War that was.
Yeah, yeah, that's what our friend Gene Bajalad calls Force the Vote, the Lebanese Civil War for podcasters. You know, people talking about it like, oh man, I went through some shit. There was Force the Vote.
I mean, I do like, I like to think that that at the end of, you know, my career in this space, which, you know, will hopefully be at least, well, it's been 10 or 18 years, depending on how you measure it, and hopefully it'll be, you know, significantly more, that there'll be some marginal impact insofar as like third order impact. Like, we will have influenced or educated somebody who has gone out and done something, you know, or, you know, in their community or in politics or something like that, and will be a fraction of a fraction. Like, you know, like I have the same genes as like my great, 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 great grandmother. You know what I mean? Like, one of those scenarios. But the idea that any of us are, you know, by nature of what we're doing here, activists, or have influence directly on any of this is just, I don't know. It just seems, seems to me both a bizarre, but also a function of people feeling disempowered. And it is in some way a cousin to the feelings that like get people to, engage with an Alex Jones or some other entity that is providing sort of easier, more digestible, you know, understanding of the world. And we've decoded it. Here's the truth. And now you have it.
That's what's so shocking to me. I was at Ben's debate that he had. Kuba and I, one of the guys on the show, we were guests of Ben Burgess on his debate with Tim Pool. And who's the Project Veritas guy?
James O'Keefe. Yeah.
They let you into that New York show?
They let him into the audience. Should we say your interaction with this event, Sam?
I'm happy to talk about it if you're comfortable talking about it.
I'm comfortable with it. So when I was originally pitched this, I was going to do this debate. It was going to be me, Tim Pool, James O'Keefe, and like.
And this was put on by like a Facebook, like a right-wing Facebook group, or
kinda,
who is it?
Kind of, yeah. So it's called Minds. I'm not totally clear on
Minds.
Like they do.
Oh, Mind, right.
You know,
right,
so it's like I don't know if it's exactly a right-wing Facebook or it's sort of a right-wingish YouTube thing. YouTube alternative or something like that. I'm not totally clear on the platform, but they had they had invited me on, and it was going to be me, Tim Pool, James O'Keefe, and basically, don't worry, there's going to be another left-wing guy there. We still need to figure that out, basically. And then, like, a couple weeks before, I remember I was out of the country, I was in Greece, the guy texts me, and he's like, well, how would you feel if the fourth person was Tulsi Gabbard? I said, well, I wouldn't feel very good about it, you know, because that seems like I'm arguing with three people now, so, like, that seems a little unfair. And but they really wanted, you know, Tulsi, and I could, you know, I mean, it was weird because she barely
she didn't speak.
She was essentially like absent, like she was like physically present for it, but she like barely spoke.
That's kind of her entire aura, is being physically present, but like something behind the eyes is not fully there.
Tulsi, it's like you're not present anymore.
Emma, she walked out. And she, as she sat down, she kind of turned around to sit down, you know, give him a little something.
Uh-huh.
And that crowd went crazy.
I bet.
I'm sure they did.
That crowd lost.
The energy changed a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tulsi. I love you, Tulsi.
Heart rates raise a little bit.
It was flare jeans, okay?
Sweat drop.
I'm surprised she didn't do downward. The floor. The air conditioner. Downward dog right there.
Okay. But the point being.
So the point being, like I was very unhappy about that. And although I will say I thought I was going to be arguing with her, she was really like barely there. Like which I understand why, because like if she had said stuff that agreed with me, she would have alienated the people she's trying to court. If she had said stuff that agreed with them, she would be on record about all sorts of positions she probably doesn't want to be on record about. So I can understand why. But anyway, so leading up and like in the course of my pushing about this, I was like, okay, cool, at least add a fifth person. And one of the examples I used was, look, I mean, Sam Cedar's in New York. This, like, he could just like jump on a train and, you know, like he'd be there.
Like, come in my Bentley.
I'm 100% sure, and I gave him a few other names too, but that was one of them. I'm 100% sure.
So it was 2 weeks out. It was. I'm looking at the email right now, and it was on June 11th, 2 weeks out. You email me and those guys.
Uh-huh.
And you had emailed me a little bit before.
No, I had emailed you before to be like, look, if I could convince them to include you in this, are you down to do it? Right, and you'd said yes, of course. Right, so then I was like, look. You know, and like that seemed to interest the organizers. They were like, okay, like I can get them to add another person if it's Sam. So I got back to them and they were like, oh yeah, sure. Let's do that. Right. So everything's looking good for Sam being included in this. I remember being very relieved about this because
they email me and then you email all of us. Uh-huh. They email me and CCU and there's a couple of these, you know, big minds on the email. They're big fans of my work and this and that. And but it turns out that they spoke with they spoke with their legal team, and they wouldn't be able to turn around a contract in time. Now, let me just say that, like, when
did you get this before in Hollywood?
The idea that these people are drawing up unique contracts for each person, like, we're not going to be able to turn this around, as opposed to like the difference between the contract that you signed to do this and mine, I imagine, would be to change our names.
Yep.
And then maybe just, you know, quadruple the fee.
Sure.
And I'm joking. I would have done it for free. I was like, I'll pay you. Like, I'll just be there. I don't care. Like, you know, give me a beer when I get there, or I'll pay for the beer. I don't give a shit. And they were like, they informed us they wouldn't be able to turn around a contract in time and update all the rest of the contracts that are already in place, because you know that every time you go to one of these like group things. Mm. They list every single guest that's in there, and that's a contractual term. And I'm being facetious. Of course
it's not. I didn't. In fact, I'm pretty sure that the original contract I signed didn't include Tulsi's name, and I never
got it. And they brought her out.
Of course not. Of course not. I never got it. Of course not. That would be absurd. It would be absurd. And so they go on to write this and that, and I go,
I think we could be somewhere between 98% and 99% certain that Tim Pool specifically.
Well, said, my response was, I appreciate the attempt. Had I found a taker, I would bet my kids' college funds, as people know, I'm very, very willing to do that in certain circumstances, that Tim Pool would have none of it. And that was basically it. And they didn't respond for like a week or two and, you know, wanted to talk about. And I guess we did have some type of meeting. I guess we were going to talk about.
You and them were going to do like a Zoom to like talk about doing stuff in the future, right?
Yeah. And I think I basically was like, look, whatever you're interested in doing, but I know that Tim Pool will never, ever get into it, and none of these people will.
Yeah. If you can get them there.
I'm like, if you can get them there, I'll be there. And that was basically it. It was, and I was a little cryptic with Tim at one point, I think on Twitter about this. But nevertheless, you were in to do that. We sort of got caught on a tangent.
No, we got derailed. But I think Jason was going to describe the experience of doing that.
Because you were talking about, like, you know, how people really are looking for truth tellers. And that's what I thought was interesting, because I'd never really, other than seeing your show and you guys talk about Tim Pool, I don't know who he is. And I saw a video that he did or something musical that he did, which I thought was funny. I challenged him to a battle of the bands. He never responded.
That would be awesome.
I would love that. What did you think of his music, Jason? Like,
would you roadie for that?
Nickelback.
I worked for a kids' TV show, and I would never work for that.
It was like Dashboard Confessional, like 2006 kind of emo kid. Not emo. Not right. That's not right.
It was emo-esque.
Okay. Right? All right. I'm on the right track.
It was a emo-esque. I got some bad news. When you go into a lot of the smaller places, a lot of bands sound like that still. So I've heard a lot of horrible bands in all the years that I've done. You just like Sam's heard a lot of horrible comics.
Yeah, I can't even go into comedy rooms anymore.
Like he didn't. What was sad to me? It's like you actually have the ability to sit down and make some really cool, and you actually have the ability to get big time musicians in. And I was like, it's kind of whack. That's why I was like, oh, you want to? You know, I will take the material that I have from 4 years ago and play a show, and I guarantee even your fans will get blown away.
Yeah, so
it was kind of lame.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Pool was basically like in that debate, it was basically me arguing with James O'Keefe and with Tim Pool sort of playing.
And they tried to set Ben up beforehand, which pissed me off because I was trying to tell Ben, hook me up with Tulsi Gabbard. Like, get me backstage.
That's what stopped that from happening. This is some
Kim Kanye stuff we can have going on here with me and Tulsi.
Basically like the gist of it. I mean, I don't know how much it's worth like reciting the finer details of this, like, but it's like, you know, the gist of it is that the point that I made in a video that I did about James leading up to this, and then that, you know, that he was challenging me on, and we ended up like really going back and forth on the debate, which is like a very simple point to me. It's like, look, all these guys pretend they love free speech, right? That they like all of these guys talk about that. But what is, like, okay, you want to talk about people worried about being punished for their speech in America in 2022? What are people really worried about? Are they worried they're going to prison? No. Right? Like, what they're worried about is maybe they'll get fired from their job. But if you actually cared about that, you would want to make it easier to organize unions so that people would have security against being fired in that way, which is, like, a really basic point. And that's what the sort of bizarre attempt at like an ambush interview that O'Keefe did with me about was, it was like, had to do with the details of that video. It was a weird thing to do because I was about to be on stage with him in this like Broadway theater in like 30 seconds, right? So it's like, anything you want to say, you could literally just wait 30 seconds and say on stage, but then it could be a Project Veritas video. But like, whatever, like that was the sort of core of it. Tim was
they were like high-fiving each other.
Yeah,
I don't know if you saw that, Ben, because you hadn't come out yet. When they saw they, and because when you were coming out, they're like, yeah, like we got them. And it was kind of a weird vibe. And what I got, and Tim Pool literally said that he deciphers the truth for people. He says he reads an article in Jacobin, and he said he reads an article in the Washington Examiner, not the Post, the Examiner, and then he decides what the truth is.
I mean, CIA should use this guy.
I would also say, you can address the, you know, if we believe that he reads either one of those articles. Frankly, I think what he does, maybe he reads the headlines. But but beyond that, yeah, that's what he offers, is supposedly the truth. Now, you know, we all articulate stuff that in a way that we think is, you know, we're delivering an opinion that we think is the best opinion, or that we're, you know, providing information that we think is the best information. But they're providing answers that are without nuance. And this is both on, you know, or there are people who do this on the right and left, frankly, that are much easier to, that it don't in any way, sorry, that don't in any way challenge the listener or the viewer to do any work whatsoever. I mean, that's basically, it seems to me, you know, if it's a one world government that is running everything, or that like the problem is this company is authoritarian in some way, as opposed to some like systemic structural thing, it's a lot easier to address and wrap your head around, because, you know, we're taught all the time, bad guy, good guy. That's it.
And that's the way we decipher media. I think I sent you the trailer for the upcoming video essay. That's the first one I've ever done that's feature length. And it really is about the way we consume media.
Yeah.
And to it's always, especially lately, when you talk about what's going on lately, the oversimplification even happens in more mainstream news, even where when you watch something like Fox or CNN, it's just a sea of pundits. Rarely do you get the old, you know, Dan Rather reading the news of the day.
Yeah.
Now it's more. Go ahead, Ben.
Oh, and there is, I mean, I should say specifically on Tim Pool, like in that debate, as in his efforts to be James O'Keefe's defense attorney, he said, I shouldn't say that. O'Keefe has many, many people who are paid lavishly to actually do that for him. But in any case, in his efforts to do that, right? So he, one of the first things he said was like, because they, you know, the host had kind of given me an opportunity to say what just happened backstage. And I started out by saying what I just said about unions and free speech, because that's basically the point that I came to the debate to make. And I wanted to make sure that got out there before we said anything else. And then I talked about what I said in the video and how O'Keefe went after him, the whole thing. And Tim Pool was like, well, man, I don't trust you as a journalist, because you started off with this ideological statement about unions. And it's like, when the fuck did I ever claim to be a journalist? Like, I'm not a journalist. You're certainly not a journalist. Like, we're in the business of having opinions. What are you talking about?
Oh, yeah. It was the what was interesting about the end of the night. So Ben was pretty peeved. He also didn't hook me up with Tulsi Gabbard, if you guys are wondering. He
did. Well, that's why. That's why, because I was mad.
You know,
that's a blessing in disguise, it seems.
You say that now, Emma, but I'm trying to get a power couple here.
Well, you could be the future first. What do they call the VP's husband? First, second husband, second gentleman of the United States.
You got surf down there in Mexico, Jason?
What'd you say?
Is there surf down there in Mexico?
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
There you go. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Common interest.
All day. It would be lovely.
Just blow into a conch shell, and she'll show.
But after the show, and Ben Burgess is like the funniest guy in the world, because Ben does not exit through any superstar or rock star exits. The MF-er just walks through the crowd. He just walks off stage and he walks through the crowd. And what was kind of interesting was people were going up to Ben and they were like thanking him, because it was a perspective that they hadn't heard before when it came to the anti-union debate.
Hmm.
And these are people, again, like you said, that just want to hear the quote-unquote capital T truth. And the truth merchants were kind of getting called out in real time and getting flustered by getting called out, which I thought was interesting. And this is a big reason why the Sam Cedars of the world can't be in the same room with these people, because you're definitely going to flesh that out. That's literally what you're good at, right? So they're terrified.
And in a funny, like, I don't know. I think maybe it's worth dwelling for 30 seconds on just how funny it is. Don't take this wrong, to be terrified of Sam Cedar, who is not, you know, I think a innately terrifying person.
Maybe you haven't seen me since this happened.
There you go.
Right
so.
Here.
Whoa!
Somebody's been doing some push-ups. So, wow. Hey, just be careful, Ben.
Okay, fair enough. What they're terrified of, it's funny, I'm staying, I'm in Chicago right now before I fly to LA. I'm staying with Fred Bronco Marketich from Jacobin, and I was telling him earlier today, over breakfast, I was telling him some of the Crowder stuff that happened a couple of years ago, and it's like what they're terrified of is that, like, they're sort of like politely going to be like asked questions about like weird contradictions in the shit that they say, or that, like, you know, or that there's going to be like, they're going to say something that's like, well, I don't think that really makes sense, because what about blah blah blah, right? You know, and it's like, this is something that it's just kind of remarkable that, like, this is the experience that they think has to be avoided at all costs. And
but they're right.
I don't know.
I mean, but the point is, I think that they're right on some level, and it is because, you know, we were talking about this the other day in a different context of that what they did, and there's, you know, there are some you know, on the left trying to sort of, or nominal left, you know, more like the anti-establishmentarian, you know, world on some level. You create within the context of like YouTube, you can create what appears to be a broad forum where there's a lot of different voices, but in fact they are all within sort of a loose network. And so this person goes on, you know, Shapiro's show, and then he goes on Rubin's show, and then he goes on, you know, Crowder's show, or he goes on, you know, Eric Weinstein's show, or whatever it is, and whoa, everybody seems to agree. Like, there's five different voices here, and they agree with these different things. The, you know, what we try and do with the algorithm, literally, is try and get into that feed so that all of a sudden, like, they're like, wait, what a sec, wait, where is this coming from? They don't want that in person, because the worst thing that could happen to them is not only is there a different voice there, but you've got to address it. And they don't do this. They don't, like, they simply do not live in environments where they are questioned. Like, I realized this in talk radio when the way, like, I used to call into talk radio a lot, right-wing talk radio. And you can tell by the way that, you know, like, I started to, because I saw how it worked on the other side. And their screeners are very specific about what they'll take. Mm-hmm. And on some level, these people are not practiced in ever having to defend their what they say, and they think they are. That's the thing, is that on some level they think they are, and they're not sure. Like, you know, I debated Charlie Kirk, and I thought he was a fairly intelligent guy. He had slightly different positions at that time, because he was trying to sort of position himself, you know, depending on who's, you know, ascendant in the Republican Party, they may reposition themselves, et cetera, et cetera. But he seemed perfectly capable of at least responding to what I said. But I think most of them don't ever have that experience, and they avoid it like the plague, and they get terrified. Like, I think they would have had a real problem if you were on stage with them and it was just like one other person. There's a reason why they went up there and they feel confident with like three or four people, because you're just going like this half the time. Like, wait a second. And it getting into that sort of like closed loop, I think, is they know how detrimental it could be to their project, which is, you know, more often than not, just sort of like, you know, making money. But yeah. I think some of them, you know, more or less believe what they're talking about. But
they're also fighting an idea of you when they're doing their thing in their show, in their world. It's always an idea of you. It's never, you're never right there in front of them. That's why, you know, Dennis Prager, I know Ben did a show recently with Anna Kasparian, and we actually have a special surprise for Anna at the live show. I'm very excited about this because of her debate.
You're going to bring, I hope it's Dennis Prager's second wife is going to be there.
Dennis Prager is going to come out and debate Anna.
Yeah. Again, which you notice, by the way, that he didn't put the debate that he did on the Prager. That's not on PragerU.
Oh, it's not on Prager. Oh, I didn't notice.
It's not on PragerU. There's like a show that they do on PragerU that did like a little couple of like clips of it that they could talk about, but he hasn't just put the whole thing.
Oh yeah, that debate is like an elective. You don't get the same course credits. You don't get the same course credits.
It was funny because I think he goes like leftists don't want to debate me. No, a leftist from the New York Times. I'm like, who's a leftist at the New York Times currently in 2022?
Well, also,
and why did it have to be the New York Times?
Well, but also he was trying to have it both ways, because like the New York Times thing gave him a little plausible out, you know, but like he also was presented this as a general difference between the left and the right, that he says, you know, we ache to debate them, which is like wonderful, because like at the beginning of that debate, the Anna played that clip and she read off tweets from me, from Sam, from Bosch, and you know was like, look, I don't think you have to ache, man. I think that like there are a lot of content, you know, there are a lot of people here who are more than happy to do this, and which you'd think he would have prepped an answer for.
Debate Thomas Friedman.
Well, yeah. Also, but the other thing too is, I mean, aside from the fact that you know, the so-called leftists at the New York Times are far and few between, Dennis Prager is not like the status is not the same. Like, you know, Dennis Prager says, like, you know, I demand to debate somebody on the New York Times, and then they cut to like a penis enlargement ad, or you know, some like gold shilling. I'm sorry, like, and then I think we did you know, I said this before in the program, Dennis Prager is us,
right?
Like, you know, like he can, like, you know, he can go to work every day in a jacket and tie if he wants. But sorry, dude, you're just an AM talk show host. Mm. And whatever led you in your life to where you are in this station, that's what you are. That's what we're doing. You're just a YouTuber with a slightly better, you know, subsidy on your signal. But nobody's listening to AM talk radio anyways anymore. I mean, so that was the other part of that. Was just like, yeah, there's a reason why, you know, New York Times people aren't going to debate you, because they don't even know who the fuck you are, dude.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's like, yeah, at that point, what does that prove? It's like, yeah, people are like, yeah, people at the New York Times aren't going to debate, you know, Dennis Prager, which is like about as significant to say that like Dennis Prager doesn't want to debate somebody who's I don't even know what would be as far beneath the New York Times level as Prager U is for Prager U, but it's like, I don't know, there's like a guy who's like screaming at a street corner who like Dennis Prager won't like visit the street corner and debate.
I mean, he lets callers on his show, and I called it, well, I didn't call in, I sort of called in to his show.
Sure.
I had a caller who sort of like brought me into his phone call on his program
to get past them, and
to get past the screener.
Yeah.
But the point is like,
he hung up.
You have callers on your show. You're not going to have callers that disagree with you? Like, you know, like, I mean, and here's the thing. Here's the beautiful thing, too. The idea that I am going to increase the size of my platform because I've been on Dennis Prager's show is laughable. First of all, 98% of his audience do not know how to operate a computer.
Ooh.
Without, you know, like they can do their Facebook video conference call with their kids and stuff like that. But, you know, they're not coming to watch this show. That's not happening with Prager. It's really honestly like there's a lot of shows where I could imagine I would get some type of bump. Not really on the right. It's really more just like screwing up. This is the thing that I think they understand. I don't care that I'm not going to get a bump from being on their show. I'm there. Not to enhance my show. I'm there to fuck up theirs. Honestly, I'm there to ruin their, not to develop a relationship with their audience. I'm there to ruin their relationship with their audience. That's what I'm there to do. And that's what they understand. Like, I'm not there to,
And any future audience that might come across what you do there, right?
I am there specifically to mess up their relationship with their audience. And that is, I think, the thing that I think genuinely makes them nervous is that I don't care about going back on their audience. I don't expect any bump from their audience. I am there to ruin their relationship, not to get involved with any of them. And I think that's, but getting back to like the way that sort of the people in the left perceive the role that we play, like, how big of a phenomena is that? Or is it just that we hear more about that stuff because it is from a, you know, like one thing they tell you in talk radio is like, don't get too caught up in what you hear from your callers, mm-hmm. because they represent a tiny, tiny fraction of your audience, and they are like qualitatively different than your audience, because most people don't call into a radio show. And so there's a certain uniqueness. Now, it may be a little bit different in the context of podcast, but that, you know, and I think there is, there's a similar dynamic, I think.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I've got to say, I don't want to sidetrack because I'm really curious about what the like what the sort of like Air America callers who were unrepresented of the audience were like. Is it like people who are like, you know, who are like calling in with the like 2004 election conspiracies or like
people what's mad at Bush, dude?
Well, it wasn't necessarily that they were unrepresentative in terms of it's just that. There was no particular algorithm. It's just that the idea of like how many people call into a radio show.
Sure.
And like, what is like, how are they, you know, specifically situated? You know, I mean, I think it's like callers will confirm or edify positions you already have. Mm-hmm. And they will become, you know, it's like anything. You're always looking for confirmation on some level of, sure, of ideas that you have. I think you can glean some things, but it more had to do with like, don't let calls set your agenda. Mm-hmm. I think it was really more the advice, which I think was true. I mean, and remember now, like we're particularly in AM talk radio, your audience could be a million people on any given day. You're doing drive time. We were doing drive time in LA and, you know, the slot sort of adjacent to drive time in New York, Chicago, Texas, you know, Austin, Miami. We were in 8 of the top 10 markets and you're talking to like 12 people from across the country. Maybe if you take 12 calls that day, you know, it's just statistically speaking, you're not necessarily getting an, you know, but the big trick was like,
it's not a big randomized sample for sure.
No,
yeah.
No.
Yeah. And I think there probably is something that's similar. That's true. That like, I think probably some of what we're talking about sort of media figure on media figure drama is probably unrepresentatively of concern to people who like leave comments and all of that stuff. Like that's gotta be true. Right.
We all go out into the world, right? We're going to go out into the world on Sunday and talk to people. Yeah. I mean, Ben actually came down. Ben's a good friend and actually came to visit me.
Yes, Sam.
Listen, soon, I'll definitely be there.
I mean, Mexico sounds great.
Tell them how pretty it is on the
day. It is beautiful.
Are you guys in the same spot right now?
No, not right now. Not right now. But a couple months ago, I was in. We recorded an episode on Jason's Terrace while I was in Mexico. He said it was the first in a series of episodes that he was going to do where he kidnapped white people and like recorded podcasts with them on his front porch. But it is very beautiful down there. But yeah, it's. I mean, it's certainly true that like nobody ever like I've had. I mean, you know, we were talking about like I've never had somebody who came up to me like you know that I'm like out at a bar or somebody and like you know something and you know, I mean, not that this is like a super regular occurrence or whatever, but like yeah, sure, sometimes somebody might be like yeah, you know, I watched this or that or I liked it or whatever. Like nobody's ever there to like challenge me about like fucking force the vote or whatever, you know, like nobody's, you know, that's not what's happening. Right. So it's like, yeah, I agree. I think that stuff is unrepresentative, and I think that's, which is good. Cause I mean, this kind of goes back to where we started the whole thing about like what sort of role this can play and can't play that. Like, I think it can, one role it could play, and like all the stuff with the debates and all that, like is relevant to this, is I do think, not in a huge way, I don't want to overstate it, but I think it can like peel off some people from like falling into bad views, or some people who'd even had bad views can, you know, can come off of it. I mean, anybody who does that stuff regularly will have people tell them that like, you know, I used to be a libertarian, whatever, you know, now I'm not anymore, and, you know, that's I like that, you know, but like that's one role. And then another one is that it can provide some sure entertainment for sure, edification, intellectual clarification, and also just like a sense of community to to people who, you know, who might not feel it otherwise when they when they're sort of engaged with this kind of stuff, which I think is, you know, because given that you do have to, like, if you want to actually engage in political activity that will change the world in some way, like, at some point you have to, like, log off and, like, you know,
do stuff,
right? You have
touch
to talk
political grass.
Yeah, you have to knock on doors. You have to, like, talk to your coworkers about union or whatever, like, whatever it is, right? Like, you have to do stuff out in the world, and there your, you know, your YouTube friends, you know, can't directly help you, you know, but what it can do, right? And both, and this is in terms of both relationship with like the show and also with other people who consume it, that is actually valuable is provide a sense of community that can like actually help sustain you while you do that stuff, which is actually huge.
Yeah. All right, guys. So it is Sunday night, October 23rd, 3 days from now, not even 2 days from now.
2 days, yeah.
In Los Angeles. The venue again?
The Terragram Ballroom.
The Terragram Ballroom.
Beautiful downtown Los Angeles.
Where do I get tickets? If at the last minute, I decide to tell my children, here is some food. It's in the refrigerator. Just go to it, guys. Have whatever you want. Yes. Please don't tell your mother I did this. and I shoot out to LA and then take the red eye back. So I'm here on the Monday. What website do I go to get ticket information? Oh, yeah. All right. Magic.
Yeah, so it's Ticketmaster. If you go to, I'm pretty sure any of our Twitter accounts right now.
Just go to Terragram. Terragram, Graham, ballroom.com, and just click on the give them a revolution for October 23rd. And you press tickets, and then it'll take you somewhere to buy them.
I'm pretty sure all of our pinned tweets have links to that. Or you can
a nice trailer for it as well.
That's true. It's true. We do have a nice trailer for it.
We still want to come to New York in November.
Do you think November is possible? Or
you don't need my permission.
Yeah, we do. We were like, let's hook up with Sam and Emma, and let's go do a New York thing.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, probably after the election, right?
Yeah.
We want to have an election party.
Yeah, wow.
Well, that was the original idea, but are we going to be able to, like, I wasn't clear on where we're at with, like,
you're not going to be able to get a venue.
I think we're going to have to. I think
we're
going
to have to do it outside.
Yeah.
Oh, was it snowing in November?
Probably,
and it won't be pleasant.
Well, guys,
we'll do a show in New York indoors. It won't be on election night, but it will happen before long. We will make Sam abandon his children and come to it. It'll be a good time.
Fantastic. All right, guys, thanks so much for coming on. Good luck Sunday night, and we'll send Matt out there with our best wishes. We're giving him a makeover, and we're putting him in.
Oh yeah, nice Jason's job. Got the Left Reckoning tank on it.
Oh nice, yeah.
Well,
I gotta nab one of those.
All right, guys, thanks again. Really appreciate it.
Thanks,
we'll put a link to the ticket sales at. I guess it's a freebie Friday. I don't know how we would. God, unbelievable!
More freebies than not.
Yeah, this is like February should be the Freebie Friday month, but instead it was like Froctober, Freetober.
February because it starts with the word free? Oh, okay. February?
Freetober.
Freebuary.
Yeah. I don't know if I like it. I don't think we can take any calls today, folks, but we will take calls on Monday.
Yes.
We will be back here on Monday. We've got a great show planned for you. We are only 3 weeks out to
the election.
January 6th committee subpoenas Trump.
But they did that already, right?
I don't. I think they were talking about it, but now they've done it officially.
Like they formally issued it.
So they voted unanimously like a week ago, and now they just did it?
Okay. Yeah, because remember, if you'll remember from yesterday, we were talking to them about they were having trouble finding an attorney who would accept
it.
The subpoena.
Ah, okay.
And now it seems as if they've found one.
Let's read some IMs. There's a great new leftist publication, Common Insider. There's nothing like Common Insider in the morning, says Nug Ringler. I don't know what that means.
Gross.
Wait, what is...
It was...
Caribbean
That's
Doc.
That's not even a funny one.
Solidarity with VPG Union, Santa Clara Doctors Union in San Jose, California, announced their strike this week after 93% of the members voted to strike last week. They have worked through the pandemic without a contract for the past 2 years. If they strike, it'll be the largest strike of doctors in recent history with over 400 doctors participating. We should look into that for a Wednesday show. Dwuber. The only other Majority Report listener I ever met in the world was volunteering as a canvasser for Beto in 2018. Your audience is mostly people who do stuff. You have unionizers. Would love more interviews with folks in all sorts of volunteer positions to get a sense for what to do and what's important. That's a good idea. I mean, we've been doing that a lot with over the past couple of months with union organizers and you know, these are just like regular folks like you who work at a place that is not unionized, or maybe it is, and they start to organize more. But, you know, we've talked to a lot of people who just decided one day, like, this is BS, what's going on, and we need to start a union.
Yeah, one of my friends from high school used to work at Kickstarter, and he knew Danelle Jurado, who came on our show, who was integral to the Kickstarter union effort. So, like, they're just, you know, some of the people we've had are really just, you know, workers who wanted to, like you said, get involved and organize and do it in a difficult place sometimes when it comes to digital organizing or tech organizing. So,
right.
Yeah, it's easy for us to forget it sometimes, but that is true. Whenever people make the critique of, like, you know, this is just training people to sit on their ass, like, that's a worry. But, like, I know of experience, like, my buddy Chris, both running in the Democratic Party and also working in the teachers' union stuff, meets a lot of Majority Report listeners in Texas.
Yeah, I mean... certainly that's the goal, that's the agenda here. I mean, I would much rather have a smaller audience that is doing stuff that takes what we do on this program, and in some part what we do on this program inspires, educates, motivates, provides some type of resource or help or, you know, aid. Like I say, we are, people are going to clip this, I just saw from my end, but we are tools that should be used by activists.
Yeah, I view it as...
We're not activists.
Yeah, I view
it as... Or at least in this context, we're not activists.
Like, we're defensive for the activists and the people who are actively agents, I think. Like, and I think you can occasionally on margins, like, media can be a political for, you know, its own ends, but I think mainly it's, like, to make sure that, like, when unions go on, the narratives of the bosses are countered and things like that.
Yes. And then occasionally we're here to entertain, just like Dave Rubin, who is really, really funny. And how do you know?
He's hitting a stride as a comedian.
Things are really clicking on all cylinders. Here is AOC at I guess this is a
town hall.
She's having a town hall, and she's doing a little bit of like a classic New York voice, you know, like, forget about it, you know, which, you know, some people may find charming or some people may find nefarious. But here's Dave Rubin, who...
he chose to open the show with this.
He opens the show with it.
The cold open, the direct message from Dave.
I mean,
the audience needs to see it.
The audience needs to see it, like, well, baby. Okay, here we go.
He should play my Fonzie impression next.
Just before, Tim Pool said AOC has betrayed her constituents when she tweeted out this video. So just imagine what you think AOC might do and how that might
proceed. Yeah, she's betraying her constituents. Here we go.
All right, listen, okay, listen.
Oh, boy, oh, God. All right, pause it for a second. So apparently the more LaRoucheites came out and were protesting, and she did like a New York, and it almost sounds like on some level she's doing an imitation of like her grandmother or somebody. Yeah. Like there's a little bit of like, you can hear a little bit of like New York Puerto Rican character in there, which of course is a massive betrayal of those people who voted for her,
in the face.
Who specifically said, don't do any imitations of like maybe your grandmother or your aunt as a congressperson. That would be beyond the pale.
That turned her district red right there. Yeah. It's just they all left the Democratic Party.
I'm just remembering the Tea Party protests against Obamacare, and I'll just say if Democrats were like mocking those protesters, I think we'd be in a better position today than being afraid of them.
Well, I got news for you. I was. But yes, go ahead.
Listen, okay, it's the Rubin Report. I'm Dave Rubin.
Hello. How are you? It's October 20th, 2022. I am Dave Rubin. This is the Rubin
Report. Oh, God, wait a second. You got to pause, buddy, because I'm still laughing. I'm still laughing.
My eyes were closed. Wasn't that just AOC talking right there?
He thought it was so funny, too. That was good stuff. That was good stuff. But wait a second. He'll explain why it's funny.
All right, listen, okay, it's the Rubin Report. I'm Dave Rubin.
Hello. How are you? It's October 20th, 2022. I am Dave Rubin. This is the Rubin Report. We are live streaming on Rumble, YouTube, and Blaze TV. Subscribe if you have not. And that cold open there, that is AOC giving a little talk in her home district. And the protesters continue to show up. They don't like her very much. They think she's one of the key pieces leading us to this bizarro war in Ukraine. They've had it with cutting off kids' genitals. They don't like her general disposition.
Pause it for a second. Okay, so let's just be clear here. The bizarro war in Ukraine that we started by having Russia invade them.
That's the bizarro part, is it wasn't us that did the invasion.
It's pretty bizarro. And then cutting off kids' genitals.
Oh, he's leaning into that.
Oh, yeah, he's...
Full
gotta get on that transphobia train, because he's running so hard from his audience, having found out that he and his husband had children with surrogate moms. But continue. Here we go. He's...
Given the situation...
Okay. She gave him exactly what they were... Hey, yeah, you came, you did. Her reign of terror is almost over. I'm telling you, she's got a chance to lose this election. She really does. We can get rid of these people. And what do I always tell you guys? The post-woke world, to get in it, it's not... We have to just map
what
it would
look like. Pause it for one second. We should also say that, and I would encourage somebody to do this, because we're not going to do it. If you compile every prediction, electoral prediction, that Dave Rubin has made over the past, like, 6 years, you will find that... he was convinced something was happening out there and people are leaving the Democratic Party in droves. This was in the run-up to the 2018 election, which had record turnout in the century for Democrats in an off-year election. It is possible that AOC could lose her election in the sense that she's participating in an election. And
it's within the realm of possibilities, potentially.
The likelihood of Republican voters voting against her because of these LaRouche protesters, I would say, is pretty small.
Yeah.
But her reign of terror is almost over. And of course, but he, listen to what he wants to go back to.
Yeah, this is like his political utopia.
Yeah.
Yeah, you came, you did.
Her reign of terror is almost over. I'm telling you, she's got a chance to lose this election. She really does. We can get rid of these people. And what do I always tell you guys? The post-woke world, to get it, it's not... We have to just map what it would look like to really be beyond all of these people and just say, turn the clock back 10 years ago and all feel good about America again and have some liberals, have some conservatives battle it out. But we're all like, okay, America's good. Let's roll.
Pause it.
And then
10 years ago was 2012. This was when there was an adamant insistence that the president of the United States was born in Kenya, was not an American, was a secret Muslim.
Mitt Romney's car elevator was at the top of the news cycle. He was saying that half the country is taking from,
right.
from society.
Republicans had retaken the House, at least, because reaction against Obamacare.
Right.
Mitt Romney not only said that half the country were takers, not makers, he also said that he'd be president by now if, when his grandfather lived in Mexico, his last name was Ramirez instead of Romney, which, of course, I think was a slight misunderstanding of the trajectory of, that his life took because his father was named Romney. Also, Dave Rubin would have found that he was not allowed to have the right to marry his husband, never mind have children together. But that's the place he wants to return to. Let's get back. Does he say more about like a post woke world?
Yeah.
You
want to play?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'd be looking in the rear view mirror going, A-O, see you later. We don't want anything to do with you people. So today,
wait, go back a little bit here, because this, and I don't, you don't have to cut to me, just stay. For some reason, he goes into his Bill Cosby impersonation here with the pudding in the, and I'm not sure why he did that.
Do the dance against the constituents and betray your body.
Have some conservatives battle it out, but we're all like, okay, America's good, let's roll. And then we'd be looking in the rear view mirror going, A-O, see you later. We don't want anything to do with you people. So today, we're going to talk about that wide tent conservatism or libertarianism, the sort of stuff that I've been kind of pushing around here. And we're also going to talk about the last ditch effort by the Dems to hang on to power, because all of the polls, every bit of sort of cultural norm right now is sort of trending towards the conservatives, the Republicans winning.
Every Again, sort you know, of my like feelings on the word conservative, norm.
I'm using it in a broad sense. But there's a lot of good momentum right now. We are going to dive into it using videotape. And before we get to any of that, let me talk to you about.
Wow.
Ad time now.
That's just like
cultural norm. All right. So let's go to what he visions. How Governor Ron DeSantis is going to take us, this country, into a new place where, remember, this is the guy who just sent cops to arrest people who were confused about their ability to vote, who had been informed by state workers that they could vote. They voted. 2 years later, DeSantis sends out cops to arrest them. One of them, the first of the 20 that were arrested, has already been now the judge just threw the case out saying this is ridiculous. Understand why DeSantis did this. It wasn't to arrest those 20 people. It was send a message to black and brown people that you could get arrested.
I mean,
it's, don't even try.
Again, using people's lives as propaganda objects, just like the migrants.
Well, just like the migrants. But here is Dave. Hopefully we can return to this new place where Ron DeSantis will shower us with his benevolence.
And Biden, and all of this was just a distant memory. And we just had a sane, functioning president, say a Ron DeSantis, and a government that was scaled back a little bit. And if you wanted to smoke weed, you could. And if you didn't want to, you didn't have to. And if you wanted to marry a dude and you happened to be a dude, you could, and you weren't going to force other people to marry dudes. It can all work. It's what we had. It's what we had. It's what the promise of America is.
But I was it? Wait, like, it. When did, well, like, what, is he looking
when
back?
When was weed legal? He just said you could smoke weed if you wanted. You could didn't have to smoke it if you didn't want. Are people compelling everyone to smoke weed? Because at this current juncture, it's still not legal on the federal level.
If you read the New York law about next year, February, there's going to be a compulsory smoking element where you have to smoke in order to, like,
get in
public transportation or anything like that. And also you have to have gay sex.
It doesn't say you have to have sex. It says you have to marry a guy.
Oh, okay.
That's the only reason that he did it, by the way. way, the only reason, this is how Dave can have an out with his audience. The only reason that he's married to a man is because he was compelled to by law.
I think the leftist tricked me.
Too much forced gay marriage.
And it said I had to marry my husband.
You wanted to marry a dude. You didn't have to marry a dude. There you go. There's Dave Rubin for the day, ladies and gentlemen. You're welcome.
He doesn't have really a very coherent train of thought.
Doesn't matter, though.
It really doesn't matter.
Just feels right.
Success.
Yep. Very, very successful. What should we... let's do this. This is an interesting... Because this there's a debate in Oklahoma. There's a chance for a Democrat to win the governorship in Oklahoma. We mentioned this the other day. It's really sort of surprising.
Which, speaking of bad predictions, I believe this Republican, Kevin Stitt, was on Dave Rubin's show this summer. So if he loses, I'll be going back to that interview for clips.
And, yeah. I mean, this is the state that has the nation's strictest abortion ban right now. So, I mean... Or at least one of them, and it was one of the first to sign it. That's what Stitt made a priority. So I'd imagine that this is going to be one of those testing grounds for abortion activating certain kinds of voters.
And it's kind of an interesting race because the Democratic opponent, Joy Hoffmeister, is a former Republican, and due to her disagreements with Stitt, she switched parties to run against him. And Stitt himself might have some more unique vulnerabilities because he's also on the outs with a lot of the tribal nations in Oklahoma, which are a huge, you know, kind of demographic there as well, who, you know, have also kind of had some conservative voting patterns. So it's kind of an interesting race that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be kind of close, but it could be close.
So here's and this is what's interesting. Do you have that tweet that I sent you though, or that graph, right? Okay. So we know that the narrative, and one of the things that has been the Republicans have been running on, is the supposed this increase in crime that has taken place in the country. And crime is up relative to where it was pre-pandemic. It is down significantly relative to where it was, let's say, 15, 10, 20 years ago, however metric you want to use. So really any time over the past 30 years, I think more. Again, I subscribe to the notion that the diminishment of leaded gasoline sort of led to some of this. But here's something that also sort of like really sort of short circuits the narrative. And there's been a couple of studies that have come out. Some you don't really need studies. You can just look at sheer numbers. It's not, but you don't, that make a more general point, but here is Joy Hoffmeister responding to Kevin Stitt, and watch this. This is an interesting fact.
Let me say this real quick. We're talking about Lawrence Anderson, who was redocketed in error by the Pardon and Parole Board. This matter was investigated by the Oklahoma County Grand Jury. They allege that there was improper influence. I don't know about that matter. What is your understanding of why Lawrence Anderson got redocketed and then got commuted?
You know, there's thousands and thousands of people that are currently in prison, and they're going to be getting out this year that have got certain sentences. And the Pardon and Parole Board goes through those the best they can. There's five people on that board, and they recommend for some people to get released. And sometimes bad things happen. And with thousands of people every year, the other thing is just throwing away the key and locking every single person up for good. That's not the solution either, Superintendent. And so things are going to happen. And for you to take that type of shot and bring those wounds back up and try to make those families out there think that that was somehow I was responsible, or the five people on the Pardon and Parole Board, they absolutely would change their vote and make a different decision if we knew that that person was going to kill someone. Everybody out there knows that. We all know that you're just trying to make political points. That's disgusting.
Pause it. Now, I should say, in terms of the substance, I agree. Obviously, people who get paroled, some minuscule percentage of them could go on to commit a heinous crime. But she learned this from the Republicans.
And it's kind of fascinating that he said Stitt says this, because this was kind of similar in the Kentucky governor's race, where Andy Beshear, the Democratic governor, now hit Matt Bevin, the Republican, for sentence commutation. So it's kind of interesting that two Democrats in red states are kind of going a little to the right of the Republicans.
Yeah. I don't like it very much. Right.
But at least they're talking about crime. I mean, in this specific instance, like, I feel like Democrats have largely abandoned that topic, and that's where Republicans have made gains nationally.
But this is the interesting fact is coming up here.
So,
real quick, let's keep the pause down. Thank you.
So let's talk about the facts. The fact is, the rates of violent crime are higher in Oklahoma under your watch than in New York and California. That's a fact.
Well, we'll have that fact checked by the Frontier Superintendent.
It's also a fact that medical marijuana...
Hang on, Oklahomans, do you believe we have higher crime than New York or California? That's what she just said.
Safety and security...
Hey, Oklahomans, we're going to put up a graph that will show you the per capita. Obviously, Oklahoma does not have the population. You will notice that age-adjusted death rates, homicide mortality by state, the states that have the lighter colors are smaller, have a smaller mortality rate by homicide than in the darker colors. And you will notice that New York, California are sort of like a, I don't know what you would call that green, sort of like a frosty green, sort of like a, it's like a green.
Winter green.
No, it's not quite that dark.
A lighter green.
It's a lighter green. It's like a frosted green. It's almost like a color that you'd associate with like the green of the 1930s. I associate that color with. Now, of course, if you look at, can we zoom in on that? Oklahoma, not quite dark blue like those other southern states.
Which also, by the way, correspond with, I think, the highest poverty rates in the country.
Don't correspond with the states that defunded the police?
No.
That's weird.
Odd.
It's not lib per capita.
Oklahoma, significantly darker, let's say, than New York or California. And
decent
it is
a way to reframe the conversation about crime.
Yes. And this is coming on the heels or in the wake of a couple of studies. One came from Center for American Progress, conducted by a team of seven academic researchers. Study compares cities that have elected so-called progressive prosecutors with places whose district attorneys continue to pursue more traditional approaches. The study found that homicides over recent years has increased, because it's increased in all these places, less, at a lesser rate in cities with progressive prosecutors than in those with more traditional district attorneys. Also found no meaningful difference between cities with progressive or traditional DAs in the trends for larceny and robbery. Another study by the Third Way group, these are basically like non-Trump Republicans, found that per capita murder rates in 2020 were 40% higher in states that voted for Donald Trump than those that voted for Joe Biden. The study found that 8 of the 10 states with the highest per capita murder rates in 2020 have voted Republican in every presidential election this century. Just an important data point for you to keep in mind when you hear all this BS that's floating around.
And, like, why is this happening? James Sirowiecki pointed out, because Washington Post Opinion had a Mark Thiessen article, high murder rates driven by lethal violence in Democratic-run cities. And Sirowiecki points up, you'd exclude every murder committed in St. Louis and Kansas City, and Missouri would still have higher murder rate than states like New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And it's because, the lead thing, like, there's lots of reasons why crime is higher in America, and it is true. Like, there is more crime than there should be in this country. The solution to that isn't more cops, because we have more cops, and we cage more people than any other countries, too. The problem is there's an underinvestment in people.
Yeah. Right.
And that's what's being masked now when you act like it. And that's why it bugs, like, I don't think Democrats are speaking well to this at all, because that's where it has to be. It can't be like Val Demings saying, I'm the real cop. It has to be like... Right.
This was an improvement. I mean, in the sense that, like...
At least overthrowing that narrative.
Well, the point is just the only time you hear Democrats, for the most part, talk about crime is when they're kicking the left to say that I don't support defund the police, as opposed to reframing the argument and saying, like, well, Republicans are lying to you about this. Look at these statistics.
Yeah, like in both the Tim Ryan, J.D. Vance debate, the first one, and then the Mark Kelly, Blake Masters debate, the entire framing from both Kelly and Ryan was... I've supported bills to hire more cops. I've supported bills to hire more Border Patrol officers. There's nothing about what are actual things to be done besides hiring people to like enforce the law that would actually mitigate any sort of crime.
And even if you don't want to go there, that's fine. But just don't either kick the left and say, which they're going to, the Republicans are going to use their framing about defund against you anyway, because you're the members of the same party. So just for self-preservation, don't do that. Or they're being quiet and not saying anything at all. This third way is better than those first two options, yeah, I think.
Because to your point, in the Demings-Rubio debate, I mean, Marco Rubio was talking about Val Demings, a former police chief who was in the running to be Biden's vice president in 2020, as one of the most progressive or left-leaning members of Congress. That's just by virtue of any metric you can imagine is a blatant lie. So why not even the framing of that is not going to change regardless of whether Val Demings shows her badge or not.
Right. No.
I want to shift a little bit to inflation. This is really a couple of days ago. Neil Kashkari, who's the president of and the CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, gave a little bit away of the game of what the Fed is doing. I mean, he's generally like a so-called dove when it comes to inflation. Now he's become a little bit hawkish. So much of this is really about like our government refusing to take steps that could deal with inflation. I even think like the Biden administration has some arrows in its quiver to deal with inflation, but they don't want to because of the nature of our system in this country. They don't want to hurt corporations and wealthy people, really control the way that the government reacts to these things. Here is Katie Porter arguing about what is contributing to inflation with a friend of show, I feel comfortable saying, Mike Consell. Who is testifying?
According to this chart, what is the biggest driver of inflation during the pandemic? The blue is the dark blue is the recent period.
It would be corporate profits.
And what is that percentage?
It is 54%, and that number does stay that level of high if you update that number to more recent numbers as well.
So over half of the increased prices people are paying are coming from increases in corporate profits.
Yes, the unit price index is reflected in corporate profits as opposed to other costs.
And how does that compare to historically to other periods of inflation or over other periods of economic time?
It is reflected there, and in other analysis, it is significantly higher in this recovery, 11.5%.
And what is it today?
53%.
So I want to make sure everyone in America understands this chart. What is a unit labor cost?
The cost, wages, and associated
right.
work costs.
So we could just wages. What is a non-labor input cost?
A variety of things, including maintenance and investments.
Okay. So I have to buy the stuff to make the widget. I have to have a factory. I have to keep the lights on. I have to hire someone to make the widget. That's this stuff. And this is what I add on top.
Hold up that chart, and you will see unit labor costs incredibly low relative to where they has been in on average, relatively speaking, in terms of what is contributing to the prices. corporate profits the biggest element of this?
Not you, wage growth?
Kashkari, even in this this Bloomberg piece, the inflation didn't come from the labor market. This inflation came from supply chains and energy and commodities. He won't say corporate profits. Do we actually have a tight labor market? One way I would define tight labor market is labor is in a relatively strong position and their share of the pie is growing. Their share of the pie is shrinking. So I don't know. They don't want to point out what Katie Porter is pointing out here. We are looking at two different things that are happening. One is we have a massive disruption in our supply chain that is still rippling through the system. And two is corporations are taking this opportunity to price gouge.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you can imagine being in a town or a city that has just been hit by a hurricane. Cost of everything is going to go up because maybe the bridge is out. They can't get, they have to drive around the other way. Smaller trucks have to come. There's not as much stuff at the store. Maybe one of the stores, the electricity broke and the refrigerators spoiled all the food and whatnot. And then on top of that, imagine that one of these shopkeepers is like, this is a good opportunity for me. I've got a lot of water in the basement, to be honest with you, but this is a good opportunity for me to charge four times what I normally charge for a bottle of water. That's what's going on here.
Yeah.
That's what's going on.
So what is the tool that the Fed could use in theory to discipline corporate America? Because all you hear Powell talking about is softening labor market conditions, and he has he's been raising interest rates, and that still hasn't made enough of a dent because the corporations are still gouging.
The way that they're doing this, because the Fed has limited tools. The way that the Fed is doing this is we are going to hurt workers enough that their consumer ability is so low that it convinces corporations that they can't now price gouge anymore. It's basically like saying we're going to use the workers not so much as a hammer, but as almost like a tool to pry corporate grip around these prices loose. The only other way that our government could address this, and there's only so much that can be done. Period.
Taxation.
No. And,
well, we can't do that.
Not though. Well. You could tax corporate profits. That would be helpful because if they're not going to see these profits, then and they're going to suffer in terms of volume sales, but they're not going to see the profits that are associated with it, right? Because this is, and there was a story about this actually in ProPublica about what's happening in the housing market. There is a software that's being used by something like now half or three quarters of the management companies in this country with big ownership, where they are basically, they're using an algorithm that basically says like, you can leave apartments vacant. In fact, in this city, apparently, 10% of the rent control apartments are vacant right now. And this algorithm will show you that you can drive up rents, increase in rents, even though you're keeping apartments vacant.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is you are creating a scarcity of the product. There, it's basically price gouging.
I mean, it's like you used to, in order to price fix, have to have a nice dinner or lunch or something with all the other capitalists in your community, but now you just subscribe to an algorithm.
Exactly. In fact, someone in that piece said the best way to think of this is instead of thinking of the software, say a guy named Bob. And a guy named Bob told us to raise prices.
Bob will tell you, yeah.
And Bob said to raise it 3 percentage points or whatever.
Think about a Sopranos mafia meeting, but it's just the algorithm.
Right. And the way that our government could do this, Richard Nixon did it very reluctantly, establish price controls. Also wage controls too, but since wages are lagging behind prices at this point, putting a wage and price control structure, imposing it 60 days, 90 days, 120 days, whatever it is, that should happen. Mm. Nixon pioneered this. I heard an interesting podcast about like where the idea came from. It was floating around. It wasn't his idea. In fact, he ran on arguing against it. It was coming out of, you know, World War II. This was into the Kennedy administration. This idea was kicking around, and he didn't want this to happen. But he ended up realizing, like, this needs to happen.
The executive branch can just do it? Or you can they put, need Congress?
Apparently, under certain, like, emergency powers, you can do it without Congress's approval.
Let's go, then.
In fact, on some level, I think it was to thwart Congress from doing it. Where they would have been a little bit more, remember, that was a Democratic-dominated Congress, and it would have put him on the hot seat. And I think he just sort of like, I don't know if it was like a limited hangout type of situation, but you could do price controls. And you could also do, you could do taxation. You'd have to go through Congress. You could do, you know, some type of windfall profit taxation, which would basically get rid of the incentive for creating such massive profits. Mm. Rather, they'll make their money through volume instead of huge price gouging markups. But we are so, like, even this guy who realizes it's not wages, he can't say corporate profits, even though he knows it. This is what this is the dirty little secret. And so the Fed does the only thing it can do, which is to use basically citizens, workers, in their capacity as consumers, as basically a tool to sort of like slowly, gently convince corporate CEOs that they can't get away with price gouging anymore.
Don't you love being used as leverage in a standoff between corporate America? Well,
especially when
the
corporate
America is
like, oh no, everyone's going to be motivated to come work for us now.
Yeah.
Well, don't do us like that. Like,
right.
I mean.
Right. It's a win-win for them. Yeah. Right. Tails I win, heads you lose.
Yep. It's pretty bad.
Fun half.
All right. Should we just do this last one of the number seven?
Sure.
We're already seeing, you know, they're running hard on this, you know, the Republicans are running on transphobia. It is really beginning to have material impact on people's lives, not just trans kids. We see it impacting girls and women in women's sports and this and that, because now you have to prove that you're a woman. Do you have too many male hormones? Let's see your sexual organs. Of course, it's having devastating effect on trans kids. You've got in Michigan, other states, we've seen this already pass, where it is basically outlawing parents being able to provide gender-affirming care for their trans kids. Here is another example coming from the local ABC News affiliate in a Michigan high school. A student, her name was Evelyn Gonzalez, paints a mural for the local middle school. And you're not going to believe what happens next.
And we begin tonight with the controversial painting by a Grant High School student. It's on a wall in the middle school building.
Pause it. Right there, you know society has gone off the rails.
Yeah.
Keep it up. Keep it up there so that people can also see the controversial mural that's going on there. If you're in high school or elementary school, you're going to notice a lot of those like icons and those figures and this and that, because it's for kids stuff. But there's something very dark going on there, ladies and gentlemen. And the fundamentalists who live in that area are going to find it for you.
Decode it vigilantly.
It's on a wall in the middle school building. And tonight, some parents complained to the school board about its messages. 13 on Your Side's Nate Belt was at tonight's meeting and has details.
I put my art up there to make people feel welcomed.
That's how Grant High School student Evelyn Gonzalez describes this mural. She painted it inside the middle school's teen health center, and parents are concerned about some of its content.
Now, this here is the mural in question. That was a hot topic tonight at the school board meeting here at Grant Middle School. Now, some of the things that the parents were closely paying attention to included the trans flag on this T-shirt here, this symbol, which the artist says comes from a video game, as well as this symbol here, which she says is a Hispanic sign of protection.
I feel like she did a really good job finding excuses to defend the things she put on. None of us are that stupid.
Oh my God.
Parents alleged the video game
character some bad news
is
for you, lady.
A depiction of Satan and that the hand symbol is demonic, with several even using the word witchcraft to describe it.
That's not what I'm a part of, and that's not what I'm trying to put out there.
As for the transgender flag, one parent implied it's a sickness.
When adults pretend things that are like real life, it's a mental illness. We need counselors. We need the medication that's going to help bipolar disorder fix their brains.
With another saying it's discriminatory against Christian beliefs.
We and our administration should embrace that and get all of this hate material out of our schools, because it is hate material.
Not everybody was opposed to the mural. One parent was appalled by some of the words used.
I am a conservative, right-wing, gun-loving American. But I have never seen more bigoted people in my life.
Ooh. And wants to see more acceptance in her community.
We have an array of people in this little town. And I'll be the first one to support our Christian families. But we're not the only ones here.
A student and friend of the artists, who described themselves as queer, says they were bullied throughout middle school and into high school. They say the mural makes them feel included.
Maybe you should be more concerned with your children's behaviors instead of what art is on the wall.
While some parents called for the mural to be removed or altered, Grant Public Schools' handbook includes a non-discriminatory policy, saying in part, any form of discrimination or harassment can be devastating to an individual's academic progress, social relationship, and/or personal sense of self-worth. No decision was made on the future of the mural at Monday's meeting. In Grant, Nate Belt, 13 on Your Side.
If you are under the impression that there has been some type of dramatic change in our culture where the trans ideology is taking over, you need to start getting out more and, and start reading outside of the very narrow, either right wing or, I don't know, contrarian circles that you're reading, and see what's happening in the country.
The people that spoke at that school board meeting could not have been more caricatures of the kind of person that you know is speaking against trans kids and, like, inclusion of non-white people in a school board meeting. And you just notice how worked up they get about their own projection. They've never seen something so hateful. Really? Are you looking in the mirror? Because that's how it feels. It's just amazing. I mean, and I'm sure that they hate her for a variety of reasons, probably due to her ethnicity, because the idea that you would feel righteous in going to a school meeting to critique a child's art, piece of art on the side.
Why she's satanic.
And why she's satanic to her face, in the nurse's office, like, you're deranged and you're hateful. Because there's something about her that makes them feel like, and of course, probably the fact that there was a trans flag and the conditioning from conservative media. But there's something about her, too, that makes them angrier.
I looked up that, like, three-finger hand eye symbol. There's a Wikipedia. The Hamsa is a palm-shaped amulet popular throughout North Africa and in the Middle East, and is commonly used in jewelry and wall hangings, depicting the open right hand, an image recognized and used as a sign of protection many times throughout history. The Hamsa has been traditionally believed to provide defense against the evil eye. So actually,
right.
If this is doing anything, it's protecting people from that little spooky thing.
And here's the other thing. Who cares?
Right.
Yeah.
Even if it was like, this is how you open the portal for trans demons, I'd be like, well, you know what? Let the kid express himself.
Right. It's just a mural, folks. It's just a mural.
And when the mural says stay healthy in the middle of it, you know what healthy is code for.
It's questioning your gender.
Yeah.
Even if you've never done it before.
And of course, all the furries up there. There was like, yeah,
the litter box under the yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is
the demons think healthy means injecting that 5G vaccine.
And you know, there are people out there who are. This is the implications of even this, like, you know, alarm of like, I want to go back to when, you know, boys were boys and men were men and girls were girls. I mean, this is like literally they were parodying this stuff 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago and All in the Family, for God's sakes. And I know that, you know, 75% of our audience has no idea what I'm even talking about. But there was like they were doing sitcoms where they would parody this attitude 50 years ago. And it's coming back. All right, let's a couple of IMs and then we're out of here. Finish the week, ladies and gentlemen. Sam's tight pants. Biden, Republican plan is mega MAGA trickle down. For the love of God, why can't we just say they're on the side of corrupt corporations and they're ripping off everyday Americans? It's unbelievable. You know, Warnock touched on it a little bit in the debate, but he only said the word twice, and it's not enough. Mm-hmm. You got to just keep hammering this stuff. Vermont Ben, how serious should we take the Federalist? Oh, yeah, you already asked that. Sam, if I don't pay my taxes, should I be put in jail over? Yes, ultimately, yes. Noah from Tampa. Hey, I've been trying to call in to talk about the trial against HCSO and the wrongful death of Andrew Joseph III. Can I call dibs on the first call? Yeah, try us on Monday. Chris from Nashville. Matt Walsh is having his rally to end child mutilation this afternoon here in Nashville, the state capital, because Vanderbilt has transgender services that I myself use for gender confirmation surgery, and they're excellent. I only heard about this rally yesterday when attending our local Americans United for Separation of Church and State meeting by the fantastic Marissa Richmond. If she's never been on the show before, she'd be an excellent guest interview. Marissa Richmond at the Middle Tennessee State University.
Tulsi will be in attendance there.
Really?
Yep.
Wow, she's busy.
Getting busy.
Arizona.
Back on her old shit.
Yeah, Carrie Lake. Now.
Maybe her dad can show up, too.
Well.
Is he dead? I don't know.
Might be in service to the cult leader. For the
Majewski Report. Have you seen Fukuyama's latest piece in The Atlantic? Have not.
I think, like, the history has ended again. I don't know.
Did it end again?
I think it's ended again.
Oh, cool. Well,
second time's a charm.
It ended and then it didn't end, and now but it turns out it's actually ended.
Lord of the Rings. It's called Still the End of History.
Southern Socialist, did you hear about the suspension of Ethan Klein, Left His Best? Yes, I did. And it was ostensibly because he made a joke that was sort of like if there was another Holocaust, he would like Ben Shapiro to go first. And, you know, to me, that's just called being polite. Taloma Flink. Happy Casual Friday, folks. Glad you're feeling better. After Wednesday, here in Britain, I'm glad the enlightened centrists and our media were able to help avert the disaster of Jeremy Corbyn treating poor people like human beings.
Mm.
Also, I saw that PragerU was accusing the left of being afraid of debates. I think the most ridiculous PragerU segment I've seen is where they, when they do their keep politics out of sport routine.
That's also very funny because it's like against what they kind of do well, which is sort of like to burrow into these cultural niches and to like act normal. But when they say like actually basketball players are just too woke now, you can just tell you guys are just racist.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Their example of a political sporting event was the 95 Men's Rugby World Cup in which Nelson Mandela used for the express political purpose of trying to unite South Africa after apartheid. The segment described the winning South Africa team as mixed race with the exception of Chester Williams. The entire team was white.
Isn't that the plot of Invictus?
Ma'am Cedar. Did you all see the story from the AP about the evangelical Marine officer who was abducted an Afghan infant and took her to the U.S.? Horrific. Oh, Jesus. Benny P., Sam, campaign finance question. I can't read this whole thing, folks. It's long. A few months ago when Nomi announced she was running for New York Assembly, you made a comment about not having her on the show regularly because she may be construed as an in-kind contribution as it relates to campaign laws. I wonder if you would have any insight as to how that would or should impact larger media organizations like Fox News, who are explicitly and continuously boosting Republican Senate candidates and trashing the Democratic opponents on a nightly basis. I had that same question, but I didn't want to pay a campaign lawyer, to be honest with you. But someday we'll look into it. Chaotic insight. Sam, not long ago, I saw Fenton Muley singing the Septipus song, and I knew I had to find out who the actor was that played him because he was hilarious. I found you on IMDb, and thought, oh, this guy is just some D-bag from Sex and the City and Newsline. Years later, I'm watching the TYT on YouTube, and when the video starts and ends, MR auto plays the next, and I hear Fenton yelling about politics with a Beastie Boys knockoff, making impossibly offensive Gandhi and Obama impressions. Skip ahead 8 years, and I'm still gutted when I hear the news story and think, what would Michael's take have been? I get a bit choked up, and I don't miss an episode of the live show. It also makes me super happy that Emma found a home where she can shine and grow, as I've been watching her since John and Anna on TYT University Think Tank. You've built a wonderful team here. I really appreciate what you guys do. Thank you. That's very sweet. All right, five more. Judy Rugliani. Show the clip. Sam is bulking up for his role in the new Inglourious Bastards movie. Sam, will you gay marry me? Actually, you don't have a choice. I'm the husband now. All right, wonderful. Can I be a stay-at-home husband or... Sam's de minimis penis. Oh, it's been a while. Hey, Sam, how hard would it be to set up a Hello Tushy to spray rubbing alcohol instead of water, and wouldn't that be a great idea?
Jesus Christ.
Pass. What? Pass. Benny boy, instead of freebie February, it should be February free. Okay, thank you. Australian.
That's worse than me.
So Trump could still run, got president from prison. Is that true? And people are also being arrested for voting. Come on, America. Mm. Oh, my effing God. Spocko. Fun fact, Oklahoma governor pushed to have Trump's super spreader rally in Tulsa, which led to confirmed fourfold increase in sickness and death from COVID. All pre-vaccine. Thousands who died who didn't attend. It's not just Herman Cain. And the final IM of the day.
And you, sir.
That's not it. I should say, I know there was somebody who wanted a shofar for their wedding anniversary today, or they just got married. This is for you. And the final IM of the day. Haldeman and Nixon were bitching about All in the Family on the tapes. Bradley, Matt, Emma, great job this week. See you folks on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. See the truth in the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost for drive. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking. But the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years, while I shifted in and out.